But frankly, it's been impossible. As a sort of rationalization, we sent you our program. Because we're just impossible, actually. But if we haven't made much progress, as I'll soon be telling you, in respect of your issues, we've certainly done quite a bit on the legal aid board in particular, and not unfair. It's not just that the statutory bodies and civil society actors are answerable to Parliament. Parliament's also answerable to them. So we opened our big mouth, and let's see what we've done over the last 9 months. But I must say, it has been an extremely challenging time. In fact, our program actually says managing the challenges. What does it say? Too much legislation, too little oversight, too little time. The truth is, we, for what it's worth, Jody said this, so we've been sitting here last week most times up to 11 o'clock. And this whole weekend, we didn't get text. No way in the world has this happened, by the way. The text of a printed version of a bill. Because there's something goes wrong between the time we adopt a bill and it gets printed. Okay. So, firstly, let me reply to you. In respect of the issues we said we would follow up on, and the department's here, Ushara's not here, but her colleague is here. Now, look at the committee's response, right? 6-1, we felt that you were performing very well, and we commend you on your good work. We like your activist approach, and it still remains. In fact, we observe you from what we see in the public domain, and we also think that your targets may be, you know, a bit short. I mean, obviously, if you're exceeding them, then obviously you want to lift your targets up. It's very easy if you can do 9 things to say, well, you know, like, it's a South African Airways. A flight takes 2 hours, and they say, okay, 2 hours, 10 minutes. And then they say, we 10 minutes ahead of time. But they knew that the flight will never need 2 hours, 10 minutes. Now, it's the sort of thing that Human Rights Commission might be accused of, but I don't know. But it's great. You do very well, certainly compared to other bodies that appear before our committee and other statutory bodies that our various committees have to have oversight over. Yes, on this issue, maybe you'll reply to us on what happens in 6.3. You know, you do all this good work, and we need to talk a bit about 6.3. What happens subsequently? Right? You write wonderful reports, and we need to follow up, and really, we've offered, and you haven't come to us, but we offered, and let me stress, Bulalani Magwanishe is in charge of oversight. I'm overall responsible for legislation. And basically, he's working with a representative whom, maybe Sidisa will have time sometimes to talk with. She works in the office of the Director General, and her responsibility is to attend to these issues. And Shireen Saad has been appointed by the DG to deal with all the oversight issues, and she and Bulalani and I have had one meeting, and then Bulalani is meant to confer with her. But to be fair to Bulalani, he's been on special leave for a while. In fact, he's not supposed to be here. And he's here when he should. So, on all these issues, let's get to the HRC. We are clear. Our term comes to an end very shortly. And indeed, the ministers and deputy ministers does too. We don't know where we'll be after March or whenever the elections are held next year. So we don't think we must leave things hanging in there. Although we do an exit report, we'll have to deliver on some of these issues. So the DG then agreed that we'll have Shireen work with Bulalani on our side to settle all these matters. And then Bulalani will come and give the committee a report early in the third quarter to say how far we've gone. We've got much time in July and so on, because we will not be sitting with legislation. So there will be more progress, HRC, in July, early August. But we will give you Bulalani's cell number as well. Okay, now on 6.4, we observed that 6.5, that's observed. Yes, we have raised this, and 6.5, the department will reply to that. Can you do that quickly? Who's going to speak on behalf of the department? On why we haven't ratified the International Convention. I raised this with the Minister and the Deputy Minister. There are some very legitimate reasons I'm not saying to you. But perhaps Shireen wants to speak.
I also just introduced the team. Other members from the Constitutional Development section, while the line function was dealing with the Chapter 9. Selo Chilwani, whom you've met, is the directing that section. And Simon Mashlangu, also from Constitutional Development. With respect to the ratification, Chair, there are many processes internally that we're still undergoing because of the ratification and some of the implications. Also, having regard to the fact that it's a whole clustered approach and one can't have one I think before this committee, we've raised that as an issue, one department responsible. And we still haven't managed the coordination of that as effectively as possible to ensure the ratification happens as quickly as the commission has raised. So there are processes underway, and as soon as we have a full-on discussion within the cluster, the social cluster, we would be able to give you a time period.
Julian is taking notes, and we're going to follow up. You will give the draft initially to Bulalani to look at that.
I've only joined this process. I know that it has been raised within the social cluster, and this is the DG cluster, and this is where the issues were as to which department will take the final line function responsibility because of the clustered approach and the integrative approach of the principals within the covenant.
I have to, by the way, leave this committee. I'm sorry to be rude, but there are the last 48 hours of the quarter, and there are things we have to attend to. So, Khadija, I'll come to you in the next half an hour. It's fine because I can't read it and deal with the issues I have to do. Thanks, yeah.
Thank you, Chair. I think that the Commission notes that recognizes some of the complexities, particularly with regard to possibly an area like the right to work, which is in the International Covenant, which is not in the Bill of Rights. And if we ratify without a reservation, how do we internalize it? But having said that, Chair, it's also, I think, an embarrassment for the country. South Africa presented its first report in terms of the Universal Periodic Mechanism in Geneva in April this year. And the issue was raised by a number of countries who responded to South Africa's report. You may say it's unfair, but South Africa is expected almost to be the leader with regard to human rights, both nationally and internationally. And when it doesn't manifest the kind of energy in taking that leadership, it impacts on all of us, not just government, but all of us as South Africans involved in it. So we would urge them to speed up the process at the very least.
Thanks, Chair. Also, I mean, if you look at the South Africa's report to the Universal Periodic Review and the Human Rights Council, the response to the questions about ratification was that we're in the process of ratifying. Now, it will be interesting to know exactly what are this process entail, especially when the covenant was signed in 1998, and we were told that, well, what was expected was that one of the departments, I think the Department of Labor, must then submit relevant documents in Parliament to formalize that. And then there are also a number of outstanding international covenants which we think are very important. I think one of them is International Covenant on the Rights of Migrant Workers and Their Families, especially after this recent xenophobic attacks. And then OPCAT also, which my colleagues will talk about. But also, Chair, what is of concern to us is that South Africa is also not giving effect to its treaty reporting obligations. There are many reports which are outstanding. From that, from CEDAW, and so forth. And the website of the High Commissioner has actually given a detailed list of all the outstanding reports. And also, if you look at the report again, South Africa is also ignoring letters of special rapporteurs. The Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination made recommendations in 2006 that South Africa must come up with a hate speech bill. South Africa was given a year to respond. South Africa has not done so. So I'm not wanting to put colleagues on the spot, but I think it's an issue which the committee itself must really raise, especially when we're approaching the end of the term of this parliament, to say now 14 years or 10 years later, really, what have we achieved as far as international human rights arena is concerned. And of course, we have said we'll gladly assist the government to, you know, in doing this report. I mean, we actually used to assist government a lot. The first report to the African Commission was actually drafted to a large extent by us. And Taylor may also sneak in this other point. Next year is the Durban Review in Geneva or Paris. Now, we had a world conference here in 2001, which we actually hosted. And one of the declarations provided that South Africa must actually come up with a national action plan to combat racism and xenophobia. That was 2001. There's still no plan. And I'm really hoping that, you know, colleagues could basically speed up on this process. But we are also committing ourselves to help them where we can.
You know, the thing that arises here, it's not about your department, not about this. It's about how much of our failure to do this is really an issue of challenges around capacity, that people are overworked. I mean, I know it's you and others. By the way, Judge Van Zyl, our report, I don't know, Lolly, can you give it to them, on the child justice, but I gather you're here for that. Yeah. For those, I think the Human Rights Commission will also be interested in the report. The debate takes place this afternoon for those of you who can't stay. But look, you know, very quickly, how much of this is related to challenges around capacity? How much is it related to technical and other political problems that derive from our signing these things? And how much of it is actually a lack of, say, will, empathy, about capacity? Because ultimately, the issue of capacity is related to the issue of will as well. Because if you have limited capacity, you choose to prioritize. The question that arises is, why would you prioritize other things than this? So if you can do only 5 out of 10 things, you are answerable for the 5 you choose. Now, can somebody help us? How are we going to settle this matter? We can't drag on. A is, have you been conferring with the department on this matter? Have you been having meetings with them about it? What's the outcome?
Yeah, we have raised this matter. If I may take you back, in 1998, the South African Human Rights Commission actually helped the Department of Justice to draft the National Action Plan for Human Rights. We actually even wrote the framework, which was actually adopted by Cabinet. And that report also then highlighted the need to ratify and sign a number of instruments. And it was flowing from that, from the launch of the plan, when, you know, some of these conventions were signed with an intention to ratify. And we kept on following them. I mean, I used to call regularly Foreign Affairs, Justice, and Labor, just to find out what is happening. But we've also, you know, been, I mean, we've written, we met the DGs, the current one and the previous one, raising these issues. Just before South Africa appeared in Geneva on the 15th of April, before the US Authority Review process, I personally wrote a letter to the DG of Justice and Foreign Affairs, raising concerns about the failure for us as a country to compile a report accordingly, but also requesting for a meeting where we can actually be of assistance. And then in 2006, we used to have regular meetings, us as Human Rights Commission, Justice Department, and Foreign Affairs, looking at issues of international treaties. Unfortunately, those meetings have stopped. And so, I mean, we have basically been engaging, and I think our record is actually
showing. So, look, what are we going to do? How are we going to do this? Look, we recognize the challenges here, but this is not acceptable, as JJ says. What are we going to do as a committee? Those of you who are more familiar with these issues, Carol, suggest, can we have a reasonable time frame? Really, we can't carry on like this. The discussion is going on for too long. Very quickly, what are we going to do?
Chair, off the top of my head, I think we should propose that, we give the department, I don't know what a reasonable time frame would be, but at least to report back to us on what progress has been made. But then the other issue, which is probably just as pertinent, and I don't know if you want me to raise it now or raise it later, while we're on international obligations and reporting obligations, the South African report on the CRC, the Convention of the Rights of the Child, is also outstanding. And if I understand the Human Rights Commission correctly, I think it's something like 5 years overdue, and we need to address that as well.
That quickly, but JJ had his hand up. Can we have this on the specific matter? Can we deal with this quickly, JJ? What are we going to do?
I think my difficulty is it's not the Minister of Justice who's going to be bringing that treaty to Parliament for ratification. It involves a number of ministries. So it's harassing justice is not going to necessarily solve the problem. I think what we should be maybe looking at is discussing, I mean, getting from justice which are the other ministries, departments involved, maybe discussing with those portfolio committees, maybe looking at tabling a resolution in the House. Calling on all of those ministers to find finalized within a particular time limit, but I don't think we should just simply target justice.
We would, presumably that resolution or report would have to be an outcome of a collective joint meeting. My God, you know, August is a mechanism.
I don't think it needs to be caught up in bureaucracy. I think it's a matter of finding out which are ministers. I mean, Labour's been mentioned. Speaking to the chairs of those portfolio committees, and then seeing which way you go. So this is the meeting of the chairs.
So we can literally, as co-chairs, draft a resolution and then take it to our respective committees to adopt it and table it in the House. Okay, well, let me quit mandate.
This is the resolution would be basically, as far as I understand it, there are problems, but there is a way of dealing with those problems, which would be a reservation to that particular clause. I think the key thing is we need some kind of roadmap as to the way forward. When is this going to be, when is this going to be finalized by? And that's what we should be looking at doing in the resolution.
Melanie, can we agree? Can we have a deadline for ourselves, bearing in mind that Parliament's lapsing in 48 hours? We reconvene in early August, and all of us are going in different directions. This committee is swooping on the provinces, actually, with the DSO bills. So, Bulawayo, what do you think is realistic? End of August? By that, well, the House is sitting when? Third week of August, did you? Why can't we target third week of August as brief as it might? Let's confer with the HRC, Bulawayo. Maybe you decide one person, Sadiso or Jody, between themselves. We can talk over tea or lunch. But then there's lunch at 1 o'clock. Is that right, Lolly? Where's Lolly? Romano? Yeah. Okay, we can talk then. But basically, third week of August is our... You see, we want to have a fast... The real word is Jillian is to say, we will seek as far as is reasonably possible to do that by... But we will certainly confer with everybody, including the department, because we all have a collective interest in doing it. There's no disagreement about that. Shall we move on? Okay, the next thing is 6.6. We've offered that to you, as I can say there, and we're happy to do it. And that's easy to do because you don't have formal meetings. And I do harass... Look, Dennis Bloom harasses me all the time. It's great. He rings me and all that. I have to do these things. Actually, he harasses me too much, but that's his job. He doesn't have to go through a committee. Although sometimes he dumps things on me that belong to correctional services, by the way. Yeah.
Do you want us to deal with the CRC report on that issue in the same manner, or do you want them to just brief us on the issues?
Discussing the CRC. Or do you want to finish it now?
We are on international litigation.
Okay, so we can do it now. Do you want to say anything more?
No, just to say that it's, as I understand it, it's 5 years overdue. The third South African report is already supposed to be submitted soon. So, I think maybe give the Human Rights Commission a chance.
See, I think Judith will speak more to the substance of the report, but I think what could be useful for Parliament and for Chapter 9 bodies is, in the context of preparing this resolution, is to understand the genesis of preparing a country report. How does it get prepared? How does Parliament get engaged? How do we get engaged? Because I sit in Geneva at a meeting and the government report is presented, and I see it sometimes for the first time there. So I think as part of the resolution, you should try and also establish a mechanism by which Parliament can be consulted with regard to the preparation of a country report as well.
What's the norm there?
I'm not sure the exact details. I was looking at the definition of torture and whether one gets subjected to torture as defined by the convention.
So as long as we do it within the
I don't have the detail, but I think the thing is important, I don't think we need to delay the meeting longer by it. We're concerned about the amount of time it's taking to have the matter brought to Parliament, and we will then go into what needs to go to a resolution.
Council of the President in Parliament. Okay, so JJ. Under 6.7, if I'm correct, we're there. Yeah, now on this legislation, let's be fair. We ourselves would not be able to deliver. And we told the department, let's be upfront, that actually it's going to be impossible. In fact, let me assure you that even if it came, we would not have been able to do it. We've got 7 other pieces of legislation. JT, is it right? There's a judicial... I see that Siyabonga is actually writing pieces on it and so on in the August and Cape Times. And I know Lolly told me they've been tabled already. There's a bill that deals, it's called Judicial Services. It deals with expungement of records and so on.
That's the Criminal Procedure Amendment.
Right, and there's another.
Remember, in the Children's Child Justice Bill, we took those sections.
Yeah.
That's expungement of records, video linkaging for remand. And then that's the one, and the other one is the Judicial Matters, which is a sort of omnibus bill.
We've also got those, so we couldn't have delivered it. Now, let me tell you, our view is, and maybe the department will respond, notwithstanding the fact that we will not be able to do this legislation. In fact, we can't do the 13 pieces that we've already got. Some were meant to be done next year. Hulalani's going to shriek. But let's look at some of the bills and see what we can and can't do. But Hulalani, your view will be seriously considered, and I suspect probably prevail. Let's see. In short, we've got too much on our plate. We just cannot manage. But we're very clear. You see, we're on our way out, and so is the, on our way out to the manner of speaking. We may come back, some of us at least. And the point is that we must finish this. The minister and deputy minister don't know where they're going to be and so on. Not that we wish that they don't come back, but the fact is we can never say it's a democracy. Now, we must get this bill. There's no choice about it. We want it. It must reach Parliament before the end of the year. What is regrettable, though, is from what I can gather in informal exchanges, there has not been the commitment fulfilled to when they came the last time, as I recall it, the night before they met with the executive, they were assured that there will be meetings. Now, there's some discussions within the department, but it doesn't detract from the commitment made to engage with the Human Rights Commission. So can we please find out what's going on, and more especially, even if the bill's not finalized, there's a draft. Why can't you engage with the HRC on the draft? What's the problem?
I'm going to hand over to the line function department. I also forgot to apologize for two colleagues, John Macubela from the International Relations. He is on his way because he can't find him on the cell phone.
Yeah.
So he's probably still in flight, SAA probably. And also Ms. Sue Paul, who is the chief director in... She wasn't able to be here. So I'll hand over to Mr. Chilwa.
Thank you very much, Shireen. Thanks, Shireen. Indeed, there is a draft, which has been prepared by the department some time back. But over the last, few months, there have been, a review of the draft itself, taking into consideration what the ad hoc committee on the review of the chapter 9 constitution has said. So there are some issues that needed to be tightened up on the bill themselves, because you'll recall it's not only the Human Rights Commission bill, it's also the Commission on Gender Equality bill as well. Yeah, so what I was informed by the legislative development is that at the present moment, they have already drafted a memo, because they have finalized the new amendments, although we might not necessarily call them amendments, but to the bill. Yeah, that, it's going to the minister now, because they are requesting that it should be sent to the Human Rights Commission as well as the Gender Commission for their comments. So as soon as that is done, then, it will be submitted.
The other thing that strikes me is Human Rights Commission, the commissioners are all having to step down in September next year. So, given the way things are going to pan out with elections looming, what's going to happen is they too will be going, we will be going, the department, the ministry is going in the sense I mean it. Now, we can't have this situation. So can you give us a deadline? When is this going to happen? And we're going to record it, and we're going to pursue vigorously, Pulanani. We've got July. Pursue vigorously with Shireen and the minister and deputy minister. Can you give us a loose deadline? You see, we're not asking you to bring us the bill just now. We're asking you to confer with the Human Rights Commission. So the draft you have, even if it's not final, it's not reasonable to say by the first week of August, you should give them a draft and seek to meet with them. You've got a lot of pressures too, because of the year being what it is. What about you meeting with them, giving them the draft by the first week of August and meeting with them before the end of August and delivering the bill to us by year end? Are those reasonable deadlines? Anybody wants to comment quickly from our side? Right, can you offer a reply to that? Are those reasonable deadlines?
We will confer with the people from Legislative Development Chair, and then...
Okay, you can confer all you want, but we are saying to you, this is what we want. Now we have to look at what Parliament can and can't do. Some things we can prescribe on, some things we can't. So, JJ, you'll help us to craft that section. Julian, you'll put it down. Those are deadlines we think. But what does the HRC think?
I think
a willingness to share with us their thinking.
Yeah.
because this is about us, not as individuals, as an institution. Precisely. In the absence of that, we began an internal process as well. And today we'll share with Justice our draft bill. So we're giving it to them. We don't have to consult. We'll,
you,
if they bring us a bill that's better than your bill, as you've seen with the Child Justice Bill, hey, you know, it's in your own interest to meet them. So we're saying today they'll get our draft. It might not be technically as astute as theirs, but we'd like to get their thinking as soon as possible.
Yes, I'm either. I mean, I know what you're trying to do. They are the department, and they are the executive. So why don't you two guys strike a deal? I don't mean guys, I mean collective sense of, you know, units. Why don't we, Jody, so is it reasonable? They give you the draft. Let's give them some time. I'll speak to the minister today in the House. Sorry, Jody.
I mean, there are over 100 human rights commissions in the world today, and we have access to their laws. We would gladly assist the department. What I find a bit difficult is that, you know, when the Equality Act was being drafted, it was actually housed in the Human Rights Commission, and then we gave a draft to the Justice Department. So it's a bit difficult to understand why colleagues can't work with us even before they get the bill ready, because, I mean, we're not enemies. We're basically trying to help each other because,
how bulky is this bill and how complicated is this bill? I'm asking this question to Jeff because he has been drafted for a very long time.
It's not like you know, it's too bulky, because the concerns that, you know, actually were raised by a lot of people within the department was making it to be in line with the Constitution, because I mean, if you can remember the Act, the Human Rights Commission Act, as well as the CGE Act, you know, they were actually promulgated prior to 1996. So, you know, there were serious concerns about, you know, how do we make it, you know, to be in line with the Constitution, and also trying to address, you know, the issues, because, I mean, already there are certain problems within, you know, the institutions themselves. So what we are trying to do is to factor into, you know, the both legislation, some of those problems that we, you know, these commissions have been experiencing, and as well as taking the advice of the ad hoc committee that, you know, they have raised these issues. These issues need to be dealt with. Can they be dealt with legislatively? Those are the concerns that, you know, were raised when we were discussing about the bill internally. And we are trying to actually address those issues. And sometimes it becomes very, very difficult, you know, to deal with such issues. So that's why it has taken so long. I'm not going to justify that, you know, the time frame that has been taken to, you know, to come up, you know, with the bill, you know, it's reasonable. It's not. But we are trying our level best, and we can assure the committee that, you know, once we have, you know, conferred with the legislative development, we can assure the, you know, members of the committee that, you know, we will be able to submit the bill, you know, within the period, you know, stipulated by this committee.
And you will have a meeting with them, and we will couch it in a way. JJ will help us that there are some things we can do and some things we can't. We discovered that you cannot prescribe to the executive to the extent that is there in the Constitution. The lawyers on both sides say, so we'll couch it in a particular way. But, hey, you know, I really think I agree entirely with City, so, and I think, Bulalani, we just got to deliver on this thing, really. We haven't done enough, we must confess, partly because we've been swamped. Okay, the next thing is the vacancy. Yes, this has been pursued. The minister assured me very shortly, I told you, Jody, there's a letter on the speaker's desk. In fact, only 2 minutes before I came to the office, I must confess, I was going to ring the speaker's office yesterday, and there was a meeting set up, Bulalani may not know this, for 11 o'clock yesterday, but I couldn't deliver. So, and you know, I had to confer with you as well. I've been out of the loop because he's been a special leave, but partly it's just human. We haven't been able to deliver. But I'm told that it's on course. There were some legal issues. I spoke to the minister shortly after the meeting that we had with you, and she explained, as I remember it, and so many things have happened between then and now, there were some issues around the person who vacated that dealt with secondment and the legal issues that arose from the letter, and she was very convincing, but she's a lawyer and I'm not. And therefore I couldn't make sense completely what she was saying, but to the extent I could, it was very compelling what she said. And let me tell you, the minister's heart is in the right place, and her style is very hard to challenge her, because she was agreeing. She said, give us your right, we have to do it, and so on. And really, I believe that it's little to do with capacity of will issues, it's just practical issues around it. And I think that's now been addressed. It took some 3 months, she told me then, if I recall, for it to be sorted out between the bureaucracies on both sides. And she assured me that there was a letter sent. I spoke to a PA, a parliamentary liaison officer, who assured me. But let me ask, is there anybody who's got any insights? I have got my phone open right now, waiting for a reply from the office. I was told in coming 30 minutes they will trace the track the process with the speaker's office and they'll ring back. But when my screen flashes here, Bonani will help me, I will give you the reply. I'll take the call because it's relevant to reply to you. But can't we agree, Bulalani, August, July is an easier month. Let you and I come to Cape Town and meet the speaker and find the date. We'll just fly in, okay? And raise this and other related issues. On that matter, Jody?
Thank you. Chair, I don't want to traverse the area of the past. We have a different view, and we accept the good faith of the minister, though. What is the problem, Chair, is that the vacancy has been open for 18 months now. The Human Rights Commission is part of the International Coordinating Committee of National Institutions across the world. We have to be accredited every 2 years. Our accreditation came up late last year. During the accreditation, we currently have A group status because we comply with the Paris principles in terms of independence and compliance with law. During the accreditation meeting, it was pointed out that we are non-compliant, and that the law says we have to have 5 full-time commissioners, and currently we have 4 full-time commissioners.
Oh, to the committee, can you draft 2 or 3 paragraphs?
Certainly.
You'll take Jillian's email, send it, and we will say, hey, guy, it's not on. Shereen, you want to reply?
So just to
actually, it's not in your terrain. Strictly speaking, to be fair to the department and the ministry, you'll have delivered. Strictly speaking, it's Bulalani and I who have it.
Well, me, ultimately.
So actually, let's be frank. We, and the speaker, to be fair, for other reasons, wanted to see me, and I was going to slide it in. And in fact, the meeting was given to me, and I couldn't. Where was I at 11 yesterday? During the report. So I didn't go, and in fact, to be fair to the labor, please, I wasn't coming. For their own reasons, because it's a chaotic week. So actually, it's more about us, Bulalani, you and me in particular, than about the executive. You'll be relieved to know, Shirin. I'm self-critical too. So we haven't delivered. We apologize.
Okay.
We're going to do it in July.
Okay,
you can phone me and harass me.
I'll prepare
a
consequence of that is that if we get B group status, we may not be able to participate in UN structures. It has a whole host of consequences.
Okay, can you write us 3 paragraphs? We will actually table and adopt the report, I think, Gillian. I was thinking it's going to be an informal report to guide us. But more and more, I think we table the report and adopt it because then it becomes binding on us. Whereas if it's an informal report for us, it doesn't help. Now, the next point, look, I have been discussing with Jody over the phone. There are sensitive issues here that mean that we have to recognize that in most governments, in most democracies, when a 5-year term, if that's the term you serve, is about lapsing, you don't make major decisions. Obviously, there's nothing to sort of, you don't be a rocket scientist to work out that given the balance of the relationship between the political party in power and the cabinet, that these issues are let's say, understandably challenging. So I put to Jody a thing I want to put to this committee, that we go, Bulalani and me, we meet the speaker and suggest that it's not going to be possible. Literally, Parliament will not be sitting except for 3 days in August as a whole and 3 days in October. So only those committees like us, Bulalani will just pay again, and Finance and Scopa will be here. And those committees aren't in legislation, but there's literally 6 sitting days. And to do this process is vigorous and rigorous, and there's no slot to vote on it. But we don't rule it out. We still try. But I have discussed with the key power brokers informally, and they are suggesting it's not reasonable to expect we can do this. So, what we might put to as a compromise, and can we put it in our report, if everybody agrees, that maybe we extend the life of this commission by 6 months. And JJ is not here, who's going to help? Legally, Carol, can we do such things? It's been done before. Okay, so can Gillian, yeah, Carol work on a text, right, for that?
We raised it when we do the opposite at the Osmo report stage. We also, we discussed it, so I must just get those documents out.
We've been talking on the phone. Do you want to say anything further, or just accept that this is a tough one? Chair, I think it would require a legislative amendment, but what I just want to clarify with you is that our term ends in September next year. Are you saying that even in the first few months of a new parliament, it's unlikely that that process can happen? Relates to your earlier point, which you agreed with, that you wanted about 6 months for, like, what you call a carryover. In the bill, as you're going to bring to us, obviously, we're going to have a situation like, of what's staggering is the word, eh? So we don't have this situation. I think all of us, the minister agreed. By the way, I do talk to the minister. In fact, she does, to be fair, as far as we will confirm, she phones. We even talk about what she's doing on the eve of Easter. Well, it's oversight means I should tell you this. The minister, on the eve of, report on this, please. On the eve of the Easter weekend, I discover, is going to Exclusive Books to look for books on crime. Now I ask, hasn't the minister got something better to do over the Easter weekend than read about grim, grimy crime? I mean, it's a weekend when people are with their families and so on. So I did send an SMS, as you might have heard, to say, well, if you become Minister of Sport, what are you going to do over the Easter weekend? It's not about playing rugby. But in any case, the point is that I did speak with her, and in fact, in different ways, and in our own chaotic, erratic exchanges that we have. I think I've covered a lot of this report. The more I am here before you to answer for what, as chair of this committee, I have taken responsibility for on here, the more it occurs to me, actually, we've discussed almost every paragraph of this report at different times. Now, I remember, for example, she was agreeing entirely that this is correct, that we should give it. She agreed entirely about the staggering. She said, Eunice, you're right. Needless to say, she wasn't minister at the time. So, it's more about that. So why don't we couch it to say, we will see. You see, we can't, like, as well enough, we can't insist to the incoming committee. But hey, at least some of us will come back to this committee, and those of us who will in fact, push for it. So can we mention that the members who return to this committee will seek to ensure that the new committee seeks to appoint the commissioners within the first 3 months of the new committee being appointed, failing which consideration will be given to extending the life of the commissioners. Okay, so these are.
If you go on that route, which maybe you also want to look at elsewhere, you also have to request that Treasury also provide necessary funds. Otherwise, you also insist that Treasury should also provide necessary funds because it's behaving, you know, that's staggering costs. I mean, if you're saying you want to extend by 6 months in order to facilitate handing over between the old and the new, it means at some point in time it's behaving more commission.
That issue will arise.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay, Chair. Just a quick one on the extension, the possible extension of the term of the commissioner. Much as I understand the practicalities around it and because the legal purposes, I'm just wondering how some of us who attend after December next year, how we're going to be able to factor some of the demands our dean councillors. I mean, this is on the light of our legal.
We do it, you're quite right. We craft the paragraph, Julian and Carol will handle that, and then we will show it to you, and then you can insert what you want in it. Finally, it's an outcome of negotiations between us on what, actually, because the executive and mainly parliament, actually not the executive, parliament fails. So we should confer with you on how we deal with the matter. How's that? There may be ways also of dealing with allowing some people to withdraw our full-time commissioners and drawing on your part-time commission to become full-time for the six-month period. Well, there are ways of managing it, but you are better equipped than us, Carol, Julian, and me, to handle this matter and pull it out. So you will help us to do the paragraph, right? Remember, we can't vote on this, okay, in any case, so the draft will come to you sometime in July. Julian, you know, other
Chair, technically it will be a third term, but we shouldn't call it a third term.
Yeah, okay. Yes. Let's less sensitive now post for the quality. But now let's go on. What else did we agree to do? Yeah. Who wants to
highest human rights.
Yeah, I think we must look at it very carefully because my little experience with Parliament, if you go to elections towards the end of April, immediately thereafter it will be recess. When you come back from recess, it will be around July, August, and then there will be no committees. So by September, we wouldn't be in a position to have done all these things.
Take all of that into account, you will co-draft it, so you look at the text and when it comes to the study group and portfolio committee, when we will say to the extent possible and so on, and we'll seek to do it. We have done some very cool things before, we can try, but if we can't, we can't. Lynn?
Yeah, the basic issue really what have we decided about the basis? So
meet with the speaker during the July constituency period, then we'll report back, and that in fact there's agreement to do it. The legal issues have now fallen away. And it must be done. We're going to do it. And in fact, they are saying it's worse. They are not accredited, or they're about to lose their accreditation. They're going to do the paragraph. So in short, let's be clear what we're going to do. In any case, you will get a text before you, and you can slide what you want to say. Okay, anything else?
Perhaps the strongest motivating factor is that if there's no commissioners, Denise will be left unsupervised, and we can't have that.
Not after what I'm told by somebody whose name I won't mention, that I should have, rather than read City Press page one on Sunday, I should have been watching, what's that, MNET's program on Sunday night, was it? Yeah, carte blanche. Okay. Then, I chortled when last time, I was telling City, so when I saw that. Okay, 6.8, the one bullet above that, Carol, you can help more here. I mentioned also that we had a meeting and what came out of it and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, myself as the chair, we were obviously approached by you know, civil society and NGOs about this matter as well, in addition to the issue that we raised with you. And the chair and I met with ODAC on one or two occasions, and we basically conveyed to them as well that we feel that there is a very urgent need for an information commissioner, but obviously this is something that we have to take up with the department. And my thinking was to just maybe on a practical level to take the matter forward, if we could have a breakdown from you as to what you would think the financial implications would be, then at least we have something that we can take to the department for purposes of those negotiations. But once again, given the program being what it is, it's not to say that this is something that we're going to resolve before the end of the term. But there is a very big need for an information commissioner.
Yeah, Chair, we can give that breakdown again. But just to say, you know, Chair, when we appeared before Treasury last year, we raised, following the Karasmal's report, we asked for money basically to give effect to, you know, a much more focused work of the Commission around this area. And sadly, we got 0 cents. So we can come up with proposals, but again, if Treasury is not willing. Yeah, and actually they were saying, you know, why are we raising those issues when we're going to be meeting? And we said, well, who said we're going to be meeting? Because there's no clarity on that. So basically we got 0 cents for everything we asked for last year.
No, I know this is very challenging.
This is a difficult one. I thought it's going to be easy. But, you know, when you came to us, it made sense. And then Carol said, well, it's in their report as well. Now, I must tell you, you know, again, I talk informally. But actually, this is not going to be easy. I misunderstood here, and I think the committee, in good faith, misunderstood. But, you know, we will start. What can we do here, Carol? How can we deal with it?
The only option available to us is to meet with the department, with or without Treasury. Maybe first with the department, and then to take it with Treasury.
That we'll meet with the department, pursue this Bulalani, and Carol will come on that occasion. Then 6.6. Yeah, this one too is a bit tough, eh? We're not going to be able to deliver. I think this goes into our exit support. Let's not pursue this thing. We can't do much about this. I've raised this, by the way, and I've got quite a long reply, and I couldn't respond because I wasn't competent enough to do so. But although we agree, this is not something we're going to be able to decide after the election. You want to say something?
No, I think we understand that, Chair. Maybe we receive allowances now. The new commissioners can receive salaries. That would be great.
6.9. Regulations on we have raised this 2 or 3 times, even in the House. The debate, Mama Shlawe spoke on our behalf on the very same issue. Okay.
Thanks. Yeah, there's been a delay with regard to the regulations, but from the department side, we did, you know, prepare the draft regulations, and then there is a requirement, unfortunately, from the Act itself that, you know, any regulations that are being prepared in terms of the Equality Act that have got financial implications have to be submitted to the Minister of Finance. So, and then we did that. We submitted the draft regulation to the Minister of Finance, and then the Minister of Finance suggested that, you know, the regulations, the way in which they are couched, you know, they are going to have serious financial implications on the institution. And then we have to, you know, try and look at other ways in which, you know, we can, you know, draft, you know, new regulations or as we amend the Act. So currently we have submitted the recommendation from the Minister of Finance to our Minister. Our Minister is currently, you know, dealing with the issue, and there was a suggestion that maybe we should have a round table with the equality experts, you know, to look at ways in which, you know, we can have maybe draft new regulation or else amend the Act, because that's what the advice that we got from the Minister of Finance.
Why maybe? Why do it? Isn't
that the reasonable thing to do? Yeah, the thing is, they were raising it as a suggestion. So we thought, you know, before we just do it, let's get the experts first, the equality experts, you know, and then let's discuss it. Yeah.
But let me also put to you, I'm familiar with this issue has also been raised. In fact, the reply was much longer than what you're saying. And frankly, I don't know whether it's one department passing the buck to the other, but it sounded credible. Having discussed with Tracy endlessly with their local government and knowing some of those people there and knowing how they see things, they're good and they're also bad. They can be over tough, but hey, they've done well in budget deficits and managing the economy and so on, and macroeconomic stability and so on. But they also can be unreasonable. So, you know, I must say I was very compelled by the reply. It was much longer than the one you gave, but very consistent with the one you gave. So it's almost like you're reading from a text. 90% of what you said was there, but they also had another 200% when they gave me a reply. Let me put this to us. What are we going to do? Any ideas? Somebody at the end of the video.
I respect the point raised about need to cost regulation, but I'm also just wondering, I mean, if you look at Section 28, the part which simply says the Human Rights Commission must submit an annual report to Parliament on the progress around race, gender, disability, does that have to wait for 2 years?
Yeah.
Really? I mean, we don't have to lump everything in one basket.
The power of the nation's consciousness. Anyway, what do you think? Especially
about people. I don't know what the youth people think, but I think. That's a tough one, to be honest, but. I'm just trying to think aloud here, because my legal mind tells me that, you know, Section 28, you know, forms part of, you know, the promotion part, you know, of the Act, and it's not as yet, you know, I mean, for it to come into effect, it has to, you know, the regulations have to be, you know, enacted first. So I'm not so sure as to how do we deal with that, how do we report on, you know, provisions that have not been promulgated.
That's like a philosophical, intellectual reply. I mean, it's okay in an academic seminar. You're a bureaucrat. You're an official. It's not a practicable, pragmatic reply. Because if we had to operate on that mode, then, hey, the university environment is a great answer. And we can have endless discussions. But we do such things, by the way, in practice, in this very post-1994 democracy. I thought Carol was muttering something. Do you want to say something? You're a lawyer like him, so maybe it's a legal... come philosophically. Are you going to help us to sort this matter out?
There is a dynamic relationship between the promotional part of the Act and the preventive part. Now, if we had, for example, done all the promotional work, we wouldn't be getting the mess that we're having now, where equality courts, which are about people taking their complaints of discrimination, unfair discrimination on grounds of race, gender, and so on, that there would have been much more public awareness around those issues. So it really is difficult. I mean, I see the legal argument and the technical argument, but at the end of the day, we have buried that act. People don't know about it. Even those legal judicial officers, magistrates who have been trained, court interpreters, clerks of court, they have all forgotten about what is supposed to be done when complaints are brought before equality courts. And as a result, those courts are closing down. So an important
thank you, Chair. Chair, I think while the financial issue is a realistic conundrum, there's a way out. The Department must seriously look at how it can sever from the various provisions those that do not have financial implications that could possibly come into existence by way of a proclamation or a regulation, and those that have cost implications that could be then dealt with in a parallel process. So that's something they could look at. The reporting obligations, for example, we can do that.
The same goal. We just deployed in different spheres. Tomorrow I could be there and you could be chairing this committee. And you could, I would have to expect you to be demanding of me as we are demanding of you. So it's not about you personally or me personally. It's about Parliament playing its role. And we, 14 years down the road, and look, this equality thing, let me stress. Department, you yourself will agree. I wouldn't say to you what some of you do say to me privately, and we agree. It is that. Everybody who appears before this committee, consistently, I've been here how long? 9 months. In fact, if you ask me the one consistent thing, it's the Equality Court. I think in our budget report, yet again this year, we've got this thing. It's not on, really. So can't we think of a way, in the quarterly report in August, when Simelane is here, can we just do this, Julian, that we put this high up on the agenda? High up on the agenda, because it's too pervasive, too persistent, and as you say, it's buried. It's a very powerful metaphor. It may not be metaphor, it may be practical. It's more than a metaphor. But anyway, it's exactly, can't we use those words, by the way? I would say, as the representative of the HRC said, so look, let's not belabor the point. We're running out of time, and I have to leave it shortly, and J.B. Sibanyori will be chairing, but I'm answering on behalf of the committee, because most of these things Bolalani and I have dealt with. And really, it's difficult for JB. This is not his responsibility in the committee as others. Okay, so on this issue, what are we saying now? We've already said what we're going to say. Carol?
We just to add, I mean, since you and me and Comrade Bolalani is going to see the department in any event on financial aspects with regard to the Information Commission, then we might as well just raise this with them when we meet with them and report back.
The separation, I think, is credible. It
yes,
can be
yeah,
done.
We've
done it in other bills.
Yes,
we're going to do
and
that.
And we ask that's a possibility,
yeah.
And then
yeah,
we
yeah.
can also get it.
And you can also help us with the crafting of that paragraph, City. So, okay, the next one is reply to 610, please. Have you been doing your work?
Thanks, Chair. We have begun more levels of cooperation at the strategic level. For example, just to give you practical examples, Public Protector and the Human Rights Commission are doing a joint investigation on ESCOM, for example. We worked with the Competition Commission on bread pricing, etc. And in the context of the recent xenophobia, there's a joint initiative between the four Chapter 9 bodies, the IEC Public. So that's at that level. I think at the operational and the referral of complaints, I think we perhaps need to do much more at the operational level in terms of advocacy, in terms of complaints handling, etc. But I think there is progress on that front. There are difficulties as well in terms of...
It's a paragraph or two you're covering in your report anyway. You're covering in your short. Okay, then you're dealing with other issues in your report about we wanted to engage further with your employment equity plans and targets on the high vacancy rates in sections 4 to 4 and 4 to the report. We welcome your unqualified report. Underspending is fine. Overall presentation was good. You're very focused, we say, and we express our position to Christine, needless to say. And now it'll be Jillian. Christine, by the way, I want to tell you, Carol, now that the child justice bill is over, she is better. She's feeling like it's an anticlimactic thing. So I said to her, no, I'm your man. You want to work? Hey, we've got lots of money. So what we're going to do, Julian, since we have to keep Christine happy, is dump her with work. Okay, having said that, I've got to go. I thank you all for your cooperation. I'll be back in an hour, so JB is taking over chairing. Can I report, as I understand it, Carol will help JB because she's been doing a lot of the practical work, needless to say. And she's like a Christine type, you know, she gets unhappy if you don't give her
work to do 25 hours a day, 8 days a week. Now, let's deal with this. We are going to deal with the report now from the HRC, and Karen will help because she's been negotiating with various, and then you're going to deal with your work on xenophobia, which you're very interested in. And then we're going to deal, I think we've covered the CRC report, but you might have something to say, and Karen will engage because she's familiar with that. On the torture issues, you will speak, and then Lucas Mintek is here, and he will speak and say what he wants to. And then we will pull a report together on these issues. And then, of course, Carol's been to several meetings representing the committee, and so has J.B. Sivagnoni. And whoever else has represented the portfolio committee in this quarter, even if there are no written reports, you will please, in the last half an hour, so I'll be back by then, hopefully, even give us verbal inputs on what happened at these meetings, because Imam is not here, but he is on sick leave. He also went to some meetings, and we need to know what happened at these meetings. Ideally, we said one-page reports. And we need to follow up on issues. There's no use of going to these meetings, hearing them and saying, okay, Parliament will do this. Carol, by the way, you'll be impressed, those of you engaged, has been literally irritating me, by the way. When are we going to do this thing? You know, I promised them, which is the way a parliamentarian should be. That's the job. She's a model parliamentarian in many respects, though not one, which she and I still have to settle, and she knows where it goes back to, outside the meetings. Let me put this to you. This thing of us going and making empty speeches, it's not on, really. We must follow up and deliver. So, Lucas, I would have delivered anyway, but it just helped that Carol kept bleeding down my neck, which I don't mind because she sits next to me. And so that, well, actually, I do mind. We should separate us, Polalani, because then she harasses me. I want to talk about movies and novels, and she's telling me, hey, man, you know what? 10,000 times I have to tell her, look at the program. There's things that say DSO bills in question in brackets. I told you the same. It says DSO bill question mark, HRC, and so on. That's where OPCAT will fall. I couldn't decide, Polalani. Please explain to Carol whether we're going to go with public hearings yesterday and today on the Scorpions bill. I couldn't decide that the ministries wouldn't deliver the bills on time. And I couldn't decide that actually the certifiers of the law, what they call the law, what the state laws will certify. So until we knew, we couldn't do the DSO bills this week. We couldn't give you an answer. So we did what we could in the circumstances. And finally, we apologize. It's not an empty apology, because at the end of the day, words are meaningless unless there's action. We're saying to you, we will actually do what we can, and you, Jody, have my cell number, and so does Sadiqa, and you can harass me. But I think you should really be harassing one Bulalani Bagwanisha. Not now. The man is not really supposed to be. I'll give him another week or two. But by middle of July, take his cell number, and don't phone me. That's his area. Phone me on the phone. Harass him.
Thank you.
And he will deliver.
We'll persecute him within the spirit of the law, obviously.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
I will ask Julia to assist me.
Now the press is very interested in one thing only. Huh?
Don't disappoint them.
Right. Good day, ladies and gentlemen. We shall then continue. As Eunice has said, that from here on, we'll give the Human Rights Commission an opportunity to give their report on xenophobia, etc.
Thank you, Chair. I'll just take a few minutes to take you through some of the key issues we've been dealing with. The CEO will deal with some of the operational issues. The Deputy Chair will deal with the issue of xenophobia in more detail, and Ms. Judith Cohen will speak to the issue of OPCAT. Chair, firstly, I want to thank the committee for the minutes of the last meeting. I think it was very useful because it's good for the commission to get feedback, and the document that we have now forms a mutual basis by which we, in a sense, hold each other accountable, the things we have to do, the things Parliament has to do, and it keeps us on track in terms of what must be done. I also want to thank members of the committee for some of the positive remarks made about the work of the commission during the recent budget vote and debate, and I think that acknowledgement is important, just not for us as commissioners, but for the staff working in the commission. Chair, the last few months have been difficult months for the commission, because it almost seems that everything is becoming contested, and the manner in which that contestation is taking place is of concern to us. And we find ourselves having to deal with issues that we never contemplated we would have to deal with, either as a commission, but I also think as a nation. Who would have thought that 14 years into democracy, we would be dealing with the destructive xenophobic violence that we've seen. and the Commission's work in that regard has been both in respect of supporting government but also in respect of monitoring what is happening, and that kind of dual role has been difficult but something that we've tried to find a balance. Chair, while the Deputy Chair will speak to that, one of the issues that I think we often lose sight of is the impact of what has happened on the region. I was in Maputo on the about 2 weeks ago, and we should be quite concerned as to what this has done for the trust that South Africa is meant to have, what it has done for relationships. And just one case example shows the complexity of how we have to move forward. There's a woman who testified in the meeting that we attended in Maputo, who came to South Africa in 1981 with her husband. She set up a family here. She and her husband had a few children here. He died, he was buried here. Almost destroyed in the violence. She's had to flee from South Africa with her children. She now is in a foreign country for all intents and purposes, with her children who have no links to that country, having to deal with a government that is committed to her but is unable to really provide for her materially. How do we as South Africa respond to that, apart from having to respond to the dilemma of people who are in shelters, who are in camps? And we have met with government, and we are concerned about the process of reintegration. We do not think that there's a plan on the table. Certainly we haven't seen a plan with regard to how we're going to get from the shelters to people being reintegrated into the communities and how feasible that is. So I think for the long term, those remain very valid concerns, just not for the Human Rights Commission, but I think for the country as a whole, given that this is the African century, given that we speak of the need to cooperate regionally. But I think in fairness as well, we have to look at the problem from a regional perspective, because migratory patterns are not purely South African. They emanate from failed leadership. They emanate from failed democracies, weak states, our failure as Africans to hold each other accountable. And now we have to deal with the consequence of that here. The only way to deal with it is to look at what the underlying causes are as well. And I think in part, without undermining it, the social and economic exclusion that millions of South Africans feel can never serve as a justification, but it's there as a factor that we must be able to relate to. And that's been a particular challenge for us now, Chair, in the context of the shelters and the context of the Human Rights Commission insisting that minimum humanitarian standards be complied with, where South Africans are saying, well, it'd be nice if we also had access to those minimum standards in the course of our life. Again, can never be a justification for what's happened, but I think it's a real issue that we have to deal with. But I won't say too much more on that, but I just thought I'd like to bring to the attention of the committee the regional and international ramifications of this. And it's quite strange, Chairperson, that in April, before all of this started, the United Nations Human Rights Council, in its report, which I have here, had asked South Africa to share with the international community its best practice on dealing with xenophobia. So as in April, the international community were looking at South Africa as a country that had best practice, and in May, the country was in flames. So I think it relates to this notion of our wonderful constitution and our inability to sometimes translate that into reality on the ground. Chair, the second issue I just want to touch on very briefly is to bring to your attention that in the last few months we have thought that the need for communication and relationships with Parliament and the broader community was very important. And in pursuance of that, we've produced some interesting publications. The one is the relaunching of our magazine, Kopanong. That is an easy-to-read magazine that gives information on what's happening within the Commission, key human rights cases, human rights events within the country, etc., and that's quite generally available. But we also thought that liaising with Parliament was critical, and we've produced what we call a parliamentary update, which I think is circulated to all parliamentarians at Rajidan. This is the second edition. It's an attempt to give parliamentarians a sense of what is happening. And the third, which is also important, is a code of good practice that should guide how Chapter 9 institutions relate to Parliament. For example, Chief, if you invited me for lunch, should I be looking at ethical issues around that? I would certainly enjoy the lunch, I'm sure. But in terms of the independence, so this attempts to deal with it. If a caucus, party political caucus, asks for the advice of the Commission, how should it respond to that? Would that be seen as undermining independence, etc.? So the Code of Good Practice is an attempt to, in a principled but practical way, unpack some of those. And I think Ms. Johnson was present when we launched it as well. So these are available, and we would commend them to you, Chair. Chair, we shortly will release three significant reports in the context of our work around social and economic rights. The one is on healthcare, which we dealt with before your committee the last time. The second is a report on farming, and that report was meant to have been launched on the 28th of May, but we didn't launch it just for one reason, Chair. We thought, given the context of the way in which speech is being dealt with in our country, the report would benefit from a section on hate speech and what it means. Because in the context of the farming community, there have been lots of complaints from various sectors within the farming community around hate speech, which reflect perhaps a lack of understanding of what hate speech is, and we thought the report would benefit from that. That has now been complete, and that report would be launched quite soon. And then the third report is a report on housing and evictions that look at practices within the bond market with regard to people losing homes, and I think that report will be even more timely now with the current financial squeeze and the real risk that more people will be losing homes. One problem, Chair, is that we I think, are too ambitious in terms of setting timelines for these reports. We set a timeline and we don't, because when we come to the preparation of the report, we realize how complex it is, the policy issues, and how we have to ensure that we produce reports that are credible and can stand the scrutiny of the broader nation. Chair, the last issue that I thought I should just touch on is some of the difficult issues we've been involved in, and they range from our taking issue with the Deputy Minister on the shoot to kill, if I may say, bastards thing, and ignoring the regulation, to utterances made by Mr. Irvin Khoza, to the findings we made on the FBJ matter, which were controversial and for which we came in for a lot of criticism, and more recently with regard to the utterances made by Mr. Malema and Mr. Babi. Chair, what we want to say is that the Human Rights Commission doesn't see itself as a thought police or as a new censor. What we do is guided by what the Constitution says, and beyond the letters of the Constitution, the spirit of the Constitution. And that's what we think is lacking currently, that we seem to be engaging in a contestation around rights and ideas, which is legitimate. We live in a society where we don't all have the same views with regard to how we understand and interpret these rights. Our only appeal is that contestation must happen within the spirit of that Constitution. If that contestation happens outside of the Constitution, then we lose fidelity to that Constitution. And our concern, Chair, is that this should not just be an issue where the Human Rights Commission is seen publicly as taking up the issue with an individual, and it then plays itself out as, well, what is the Human Rights Commission going to do about this individual? Because we are all enjoined to defend the Constitution. And when we all don't defend it, then we are all culpable by either our silence or our omission. And we'd like to see that kind of consciousness being developed in our society, where we can see that responsibility as a joint responsibility, as a shared labor. We will proceed with the matters that we have dealt with here, and we will proceed to deal with them to the best of our ability, because ultimately it is our responsibility, just not to this parliament that nominated us, to the president who appointed us, but to the nation, to be loyal to those values in the Constitution. And if we have made mistakes along the way, we will willingly admit and concede those. But I think at the current time, especially as we move towards a general election, Chair, where we need to create an environment within our society where people feel free to speak openly about the things that make them feel good, openly about the things that make them feel bad, openly about the candidates that make them feel comfortable and the candidates that make them feel uncomfortable. If that space is closed by utterances that say, well, if this is not the desired outcome, then the consequences will be dire, then we all are prejudiced by the closing of that space. And the opening of that space and the defending of that space is just not the responsibility of one institution, it's the responsibility of everybody. And I'd like just to make those remarks to put into context what the Commission is trying to do. The Commission is not sitting there waiting for people to speak and saying we're going to take people up. The Commission is saying, how is it that what we do in our society advances what former Chief Justice Ishmael Mohammed called the constitutional contract, and how
do we give effect to showing some fidelity to the values in this constitution? And with respect, our view is that some of the things that have happened in our society in the last few months, including the xenophobic violence, including some of the utterances, are at variance with those values that we must ascribe to. So, Chair, and the last thing is just that one of the most exciting areas that we've begun to work in is also looking at human rights in the context of the business community and the private sector. And we're currently involved in quite a major investigation against the large mining company in Limpopo province with regard to the relocation of the community, the impact of mining operations on the community. It's likely to be a long haul. I think when you take on a mining company, you have to brace yourself for a long fight. But it's an important area because it's based on the recognition that when you give power, you have to ensure that power is exercised with accountability. And in our society, the power is not only held by the state. Private actors hold considerable power, wield considerable power, have the potential to impact on people's lives in a very powerful way. And our work in the business and human rights unit has just begun to take off, but I think it's a very important and exciting part of that work. Chair, there are some technical and logistical matters we must report on, in particular with regard to employment equity, statistics, etc., and I'm going to ask the CEO to do that. And then the Deputy Chair will speak to the issue of xenophobia. Or I'm not sure if you would prefer us to deal with the OPCAT issue first, because I know the inspecting judge has been patiently waiting, and if we deal with that issue, we can at least. But I mean, we're in your hands, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. I'll also try and be very brief because we've actually submitted our report. It's about 68 pages with annexes, but the main report is only about 9-10 pages. Except I also want to say, as an officer of Parliament and accountable to Parliament, I did not read the City Press, but I heard that I said Ms. Malema is mad. I also said on Captain Blanche that I'm not sure whether you were sober when you made those remarks, and I've heard that some of the MPs are not very happy about that, and I guess maybe the matter can be discussed elsewhere. But I just want to say, Chairperson, that over the last 13 years, the Commission has been subjected to lots of insults and disparaging remarks, including some MPs, including political parties. And I think the issue really I want to raise is that to what extent does this committee and parliament protect constitutional bodies when they're being attacked? We've had to issue statements earlier on when remarks were being made about the court in KZN on its finding on Shabik Shaikh. And we've been noticing lots of attacks, including by political parties who are members of those bodies, making remarks around constitutional bodies. And therefore, we need to, at some point in time, be very clear about this, because then, it then sparks off this kind of responses, which, under normal circumstances should actually not be said by people like us, including myself as the Office of the CEO. So that is the context in which I really don't mind if this is discussed at some point in time in this House. Having said so, Chair, I just want to go very quickly on the issues in our report, which are basically a response to issues which were raised by this committee before us, when I appeared before it last time. The first one really was the challenges around the statistics around complaints. Clearly, we did acknowledge that there were mistakes in the complaints report of the annual report which was submitted, and we were basically asked to deal with this, and we have done so, Chairperson. In that we've actually issued a new guideline to ensure that our statistics are much more credible and also correct. We've also set up a committee which will basically monitor this. And the rest of the details are in Annex A of this very long document. And therefore we're hoping that when we submit our report next time, very soon, our stats will be very credible. Of course, there are also human issues and systems issues, but we do have a software which basically deals with those issues. But of course, a software system also depends on the nature of the information put into the system, and also whether people actually undermine those systems or not. But clearly, we also have a responsibility on the other side as Office of the CEO to ensure that, you know, whatever systems we use are actually credible, and we also send out correct information to the public. I have my colleague, Ms. Annelien Fransman, who is the newly appointed head of the Legal Service Department. So next time there are problems, I'll simply say, you know whom to blame. But of course, I still have the ultimate responsibility as accounting officer as to what happens despite the PSA provisions of delegated authority. And then the chairperson has also referred to some of the reports in terms of point B, that yes, it is a challenge, of course. We still take a long time in producing the report following our hearings. When I appeared with the Minister of Safety and Security on Asikulimo on TV about xenophobia, he was basically saying, where is your report on farming community? And of course, I think that we also need to be very careful as to what are the possible time frames when these reports are produced following the hearings. And sometimes we do set very short time frames for ourselves, and then we end up not meeting those. Now, I just want to say we've been asked twice now about the initiation hearings report. This, for me, Chair, is a very sad development, because it was also our first attempt, really, to do a joint hearing with two other statutory bodies, the National House of Traditional Leaders and the Commission on the Promotion and Protection of the Rights of Cultural, Religious and Linguistic Communities. The hearings did take place in three provinces. Sierra Commission was charged with writing the report, and what we got really was about 12 pages, which was not sufficient. And then we, after a long, long time, we thought that we should actually try and take over the report, writing the report ourselves, despite the fact that it's something which is not in our budget. So it's something which we are still pursuing, because now we've heard that some tapes might have been misplaced and stuff like that. So it was actually a bit of a terrible experience for us, really, as far as joint public hearings. And I think we'll not easily go into joint public hearings until some of the modalities have been agreed upon, you know, as to what happens. Because it becomes quite embarrassing for us to come to Parliament and say there's still no report. But, Chair, I can guarantee that we're actually working on it. There's even a decision, discussion that maybe we should actually say, look, let's just close the chapter and move on. But it's such an important area of work, really, which we cannot really look into it. So we've asked, we've asked our acting deputy CEO, Victoria Maleka, basically to try and see how we can salvage this report as soon as possible. And then point number three is basically the report on access to health. Again, that also has had some challenges as far as the quality of the report is concerned. And we've actually asked our newly appointed head of research to basically look into the report and basically try and have this report launched this year as well, which means, you know, it will be about a year and a few months short, but clearly we're committed to having that report launched as soon as possible this year, because it's basically dealing with issues of healthcare services and all the challenges which we're facing as a country, even after that hearing. And then, Chair, on point number four was basically the issues of international instruments which we have dealt with. So I'll skip that, as well as the issue pertaining to the amendments to the Human Rights Commission Act. That I'll also skip. And then I'll also skip the issues of the vacancy. And then I'll also skip the issue of the, you know, the issues of staggering appointment of commissioners. On the issue of the Dedicated Information Commission, I guess we've also raised that, Chair, but it's actually a concern for us, because if I recall, we had actually requested for a dedicated discussion with the Portfolio Committee on this particular act, and I still think that hasn't happened. And Chair, I think it would really be important if the committee could also consider really having dedicated discussions on the review of the implementation of some of these important pieces of legislation. I know there was one on the Equality Act some time ago, but we haven't really had one on the IA. And my concern is that, you know, access to information is the oxygen of democracy. And really, if we don't take this important act very seriously, it means, therefore, we are actually undermining our own efforts as far as strengthening and supporting constitutional democracy, helping people of this country to be able to have access to information, which they can then use to exercise their rights as well as to hold all of us accountable, because at the end of the day, they are the shareholders of companies of Africa. So, Chair, I mean, I'm really hoping that despite what we've said in this report, that I'm dying for a day when we actually sit down and have a discussion to say what are the challenges, what can we do, and so forth, with the Department of Justice, of course.
I'll skip the issue of Section 219 about the commissioner salaries and so forth, and then I'll skip the issue of regulations. I'll skip issues of xenophobia. That will go to the chairperson. Then I'll come to the CSAP. We have this EU-funded project called Civil Society Advocacy Program, which is supposed to be ending in this December. Now, there have been challenges. It was very good because it's actually a partnership between us, Public Protector, and the Gender Commission, where we've inside the committee with rotating chairmanship over the last 3 years, which actually regulates how this project is being carried out in three provinces. And of course, there's been lots of benefits from the project in terms of workshops, the materials produced, and so forth. The challenge here was that this year the EU basically stopped making payments to a number of service providers who had actually done work for us and were enjoying the fruits of that work. Now, there seem to be some challenges there, and which we're trying to resolve. We met me and the chairperson with the EU ambassador, and there are a number of issues there which we hopefully will be resolved, because we're also very unhappy with some of the things which have happened. He's also raising concerns. So, but we're hoping that you know, the matter will be resolved, failing which we might end up in court as a 3C9 against the EU, and that might be a very interesting development. And of course, government is also involved, because this contract came through a bilateral agreement between government and the EU, and then us as beneficiaries. But also, there have been lots of lessons learned from that. And I won't say anything which will get me into trouble about the EU. High vacancy rate, Chair, it still continues to be a challenge in the organization. We've done everything possible as far as policy issues are concerned. We've now had succession planning, we have development and training programs, we have a retention strategy, which includes improvement of medical benefits, and so forth. And we have a new job evaluation system, which was actually approved recently by Treasury. And we also have a transformation committee, employment equity committee, and a performance management forum, and a job evaluation committee, where members of the union also sit in. But Chair, we still continue to lose a number of staff, and I guess when we present our annual report, we'll actually give you much better and informed figures. But one of the problems, Chair, is that we keep on losing staff members at the junior level to government departments. And also, if you were to look at the last 5 years, there has been very little movement at management level. You know, it's not that bad. Of course, we've also lost our deputy CEO to the CGE, thanks to Parliament and this committee. And that's why we've actually advertised the post now to fill that one. But one of the reasons, Chair, is that because we still pay less than what government departments pay in terms of the scale, something we've been trying to correct, but up until now we've not succeeded. So, of course, our staff members moved to various departments. Recently, the Department of Justice took our senior legal officer who deals with complaints. So, for the last 3 months, we've had a vacancy, which means we're taking a bit of a knock as far as complaints are concerned. But we're dealing with that. But at the same time, it's also inevitable. I mean, people, young people also have to, you know, move from time to time. And I think what we'll probably show is to show how at the senior level, senior management level, and people have actually been quite stable. I mean, I've been in the commission since 1996, you know, 10 years now. So, and of course, we're not saying that we should therefore say there's nothing we can do. We're still trying our level best to, you know, to retain staff. But at the same time, some of my colleagues say, look, it's also useful for the commission to redeploy colleagues into justice department, like Mr. Silo Chiloane here. So, but I mean, of course, it's an issue which we are quite concerned about as well, because then if we lose too many staff, it means we will then be unable to meet our strategic plan, you know, objectives. As the chair says, maybe we set too low target, and therefore it doesn't really happen. But chair, on that point, I also want to raise a concern that, you know, at this point in time, not just because of our involvement on xenophobic attacks, but to be honest, staff members in the Human Rights Commission are very, very stretched. Very, very stressed. So even the targets which colleagues are saying are low, this year we actually said we need to cut back, because otherwise, you know, if we are so thinly spread, then the quality then gets affected. That's why, for example, then we even missed some of the information in terms of our complaints. We also saw there were a few typos in our report as well. Of course, I mean, I know for some people that doesn't matter, but I mean, for us, it says, well, I mean, if people miss out this document, I mean, for example, as well, we still have to make our submission on the traditional court bill. So those are some of the issues which we have to bear in mind. But also, Chair, I mean, I was in Harvard a few weeks ago where there was a meeting of all the relevant human rights commissions all over the world. And one thing which actually comes out very clear is that up until now, there are no clear benchmarks of what a human rights commission can do in the country, what is the impact, and what should be the optimum size. So, for example, we receive about, this year I'm told, we receive about 10,000 complaints with a budget of 60 million and 100 staff members. Then you go to the Australian Human Rights Commission with a bigger budget, they deal with less than 200 complaints a year. And now, you know, then how then do you start, you know, saying, you know, who's doing less and who's overloaded and stuff like that. And therefore, there's also a need really for us to actually invest in having appropriate systems to be able to monitor the effectiveness and efficiency of an organization. So, for example, I mean, a few months ago, I was talking to colleagues from the ICD. They were saying, hey, you guys are doing so well, your budget must be very, very big. I said, no, it's only 60 million. It's actually short, because that budget is actually 90 million. So, for example, I don't want to compare, but even to compare the Human Rights Commission with 60 million and ICD with 90 million, I'll leave it like that. I won't go further in case I get into trouble. But those are some of the issues we really need to be addressing. Now, Chair, the other issue which we were asked to comment was the issue of employment equity, where this committee raised concerns about us not having sufficient people with disabilities. You'll also acknowledge that the commission is now doing a lot of work around issues of disability following the ratification of the convention on this issue last year. And I think we commend the government also for basically ratifying that convention. It's also, there's an interesting point that some conventions are ratified very quickly, and others take 10 years to be ratified. What informs this? But as a result of that, I mean, we then we've changed all our adverts. Now, if you see the Human Rights Commission's adverts, we now have that logo there for people with disabilities, trying to encourage people like those people basically to apply to the Human Rights Commission. The other issue we have done is to try and speak to a number of NGOs which deal with these issues to say, listen, you know, can we then send you our address so that you can also, send the word across to say, listen, here is something else. Unfortunately, we still don't issue adverts in Braille, but so it's an issue which, of course, we are trying very hard to work on, and definitely with our work now in ensuring that the Convention on the Rights of People with Disabilities is actually implemented, we'll definitely be interacting more with in this area. And of course, we do have a coordinator in the Commission who deals with the rights of people with disabilities. The other issue, Chair, I mean, even though it has caused some problems in the Commission, to say now the Commission has really done a lot to promote women in the Commission. The head of finance is a woman, the head of administration is a woman, the head of legal is a woman, the head of education is a woman, the head of parliamentary affairs is a woman, and now we have an acting deputy CEO who is a woman. So, and really, I mean, you'll be very impressed next time when we present our steps to actually show that the Commission has really done a lot as far as gender issues are concerned, trying to get more women in the Commission than men, because they do make the majority. And very soon we hope that there will be a female CEO, and that the current CEO must simply go and farm elsewhere. So, Chair, really with that, I mean, there are supporting documents to all the issues I've raised here in the document. So the report basically is 8 pages, but the annexures go from page 9 to page 670. We've also in the report, Chairperson, on the issue of the Act, also had made some, given an extract on some of our thinking around issues which need to be looked into when we consider amending the Human Rights Commission Act. And I also want to reiterate what I said earlier on, that, you know, and I sometimes say to my colleagues in government that, you know, sometimes we tend to forget that we're actually on the same side, trying to work very hard to promote democracy and human rights in our country. But sometimes we act like we're on the opposite side. And really, we're simply saying that we're quite happy and willing to assist the Department of Justice in developing the Act, even before it actually goes to cabinet, because we also say, in terms of our own work around monitoring legislation, that we'll actually prefer if we get bills even before they go to cabinet, just to make comments, so that at least we influence the system, the process in a better manner, and also make sure that there will be lesser fights down the line. We are not enemies, so we're simply making that an open invitation to my colleagues, including those who are very close to me, behind me.
Okay, thank you, Cesar. Thank you, Chair. I was remiss in not introducing the delegation. It's a bit late in the day to do that, but never too late. Sitting there is the Deputy Chair of the Commission, Dr. Zonke Majidina, with the very beautiful jacket. Next to me is the Chief Executive Officer, and Mr. Banyani, Ms. Judith Cohen, who is the Head of our Parliamentary Liaison and Treaty Monitoring Work, Ms. Emmeline Fransman. This is her maiden appearance before your committee chair. She's the head of our legal services department. And then Ms. Victoria Maloka, who is the acting deputy chief executive officer of the commission. Chair, the CEO said that we're not fighting with the Justice Department, so he was incorrect when he said that they take our stock. They don't really. They advertise and our people apply. I mean, that's how things work, so it's not meant to say that. That's the how the world works here. Thank you. So, Chair, I think at this point, maybe should we deal with the issue of OPCAT or xenophobia, or should you want to deal with questions? We'll be guided again by you, Chair. Propose we go forward? Xenophobia. Okay, Chair, apart from the introductory remarks that I've made, there are two reports in the bundle. Is B1 and B2. B1 deals with pages from page 14 to 18, which touches broadly on some national issues and some of the recommendations we make. And then there's an extra B2, which really is a list of some of the activities of our Western Cape office in dealing with the aftermath of the violence down here. Chair, I don't think we want to take you through the detail of the reports, but rather to raise some strategic issues, and I think the Deputy Chair will deal with that just in terms of, and you can interrogate us on the detail of the report, but I don't even want to tell you on this day we went, Chair. It's in the bundle. Deputy Chair? Proceed, Deputy Chair.
even before the outbreak of violence on the 11th of May this year, the Commission has always been involved in our work on xenophobia. We established a focal point on non-national as way back as 1998 when two Senegalese nationals were thrown off a moving train. And from that time on, we've done quite a lot of interventions. So when 11th May came about, we identified a number of challenges over and above what we normally do in the course of our everyday work. But without taking too much time, I'll just say that, as we all know, there were massive displacements of people. The numbers are put at something like 200,000 people who had to leave their homes and be housed in police stations. And of course, among those foreign nationals, no distinction was made in terms of immigration status, whether people are refugees or permanent residents or even undocumented migrants. But the main problem, of course, was the safety of these people. People saw the protection of police, and police responses were very bad. But nonetheless, we identified that there was a huge humanitarian problem once people had to be relocated forcibly the way they were. And a number of NGOs were involved, such as Red Cross, as well as our own local NGOs that deal with issues of migrants and non-nationals. So we felt that perhaps it would be best if we mobilized our resources such that we worked in partnership with non-governmental organizations, as well as other partners. And to that end, we then set up a coordinating committee that was meant to be a focal point where we share information with everybody that's going out there to give assistance in the form of food, the form of blankets, in the form of psychosocial counseling, and so on. We also thought we would have gone far by now with a collective approach by Chapter 9, but that process has had a few problems here and there. But having come to a point where those people who are now housed in police stations are in shelters all over the country, we are facing a new challenge altogether. And we identified, and I don't want to be too long, we just identified what needs to be done by various sectors of our society. First of all, we think that government, while the intention is to reintegrate people after 2 years, 2 months, back to the communities where they came from, this is going to pose huge, huge challenges for them all now. Perhaps the Western Cape is a bit of an exception, but certainly in Gauteng, there is very little willingness on the part of communities to take foreign nationals back. And the issue of cause of service delivery underlies all of the resistance, where people are saying, well, look, more is being done for foreigners than us. I mean, we only have to go back to Durban last week when the floods hit. And the response is that, well, foreign nationals were looked after better than us. So I think government will have to move with a lot of caution. And of course, we're ready to assist in that process. But they really have to come up with a plan, and we have to this end sent a letter to say, could government clarify exactly what the overall plan is going to be? We haven't had any response. But linked to that, I think on a longer term basis, I think this problem highlights the fact that there are huge flaws in our immigration policies. And on the longer term, after this crisis, government has got to go back to the drawing board and decide how we're going to review our immigration act and its policies. An example is that we think migration takes place in the form of either people who are looking for political asylum as refugees or economic migrants. But the evidence before us is that we're talking about mixed flows of people. And we have to devise policies that address that reality. For example, there's been no comprehensive humanitarian response by government to the living crisis. And we know that Zim is here today. We are going to have to face the fallout from those flawed elections if they do take place at all. and yet there is nothing on the table that informs our policy. I mean, we could learn from other countries out there. We can't deal with foreigners or foreign nationals who want to come into our country on the basis of those who are legal and those who are not. There are ways and means. For example, there should be some humanitarian leave to remain. And government can explore those options. It's not something that's got to be permanent. But as long as the crisis in Zimbabwe is continuing, we need to respond appropriately. And so linked to that will also be a need for government to come up with an integrated response to issues of migration. Migration is a fact of life in this rapidly globalizing world we live in. And so we cannot expect the Department of Home Affairs to be the only department that deals with issues of people coming in and out of our country looking for jobs and so on. There's got to be an integrated response by all kinds of government departments, from health, education, to Department of Justice and Constitutional Affairs, and so on, labor. In the sense that we need to devise inclusive policies now that are, in line with the present day realities of the world we live in. We cannot marginalize migrants as people who are out there. They have to be mainstreamed in order for us to live up to the constitutional ideal that South Africa belongs to only living it, first and foremost. But also for practical reasons, and these things are happening all over the world. We are not the only country that is facing this crisis. Other countries have, and they are dealing with them as best as you could. I think we could learn from that. Lastly, the issue of criminalizing hate speech and hate crime is a matter that I think is very, very urgent now and needs to be addressed quickly as possible. As way back as 2006, the Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination recommended to the South African government, after government had submitted its report to FED, this committee is short, it's called FED. And one of the major points they made was that when is the government going to criminalize his speech? And we know that issues of xenophobia go with very, very violent, example of hate crimes and hate speech. And I think that's one way perhaps we could deal with some of the most flagrant violations that we see. And then lastly, Chair, of course the Commission also has got to step up our own interventions around advocacy, lobbying, for example. We have to lobby government now to sign and ratify, as we also said earlier on, the International Convention on the Rights of Migrants and their Families. There's been some progress made in terms of how organized labor are dealing with issues of migrant laborers, but we need to go beyond that in order to ensure that people's rights are respected down the migration chain. And lastly, very, very lastly now, I think the Chair has made reference to the international and regional dimensions of this problem. It's quite clear that our government has got to move beyond trying to solve the problem at the national level and looking at the sub-regions, certainly at the level of SADC. We were the last country to ratify the protocol on the facilitation of movement of people in the region. And I think that process is limping. It is not going as fast as it is, partly again because of the reluctance of the South African government, because it seems that we are a major receiving country, but we cannot duck our heads and hide in the sand. We've got to work with our partners in the region, in the sub-region especially, and come to ways and means of dealing with issues such as what is happening in the South today. I'll stop there for now. Thank you.
Deputy Chair, thank you, Chair. I just thought I should mention on the issue of advocacy that the Deputy Chair has raised is that the Minister of Justice has invited the Human Rights Commission and the Commission of Gender Equality to a meeting, I think on the 3rd of July, to talk about advocacy. And I imagine, without preempting that, the issue of advocacy in the context of xenophobia may well be one of the matters that we will be discussing next week. So it seems that the possibility of some kind of joint activity between the two Chapter 9s and the Justice Department may well be put on the table next week as well as part of these initiatives. Thank you, Chair.
Chair, the next issue is the OPCAT issue. I know there is a report from Ms. Johnson, and there is also a report from Judith, so should I ask Judith just to take us through some of the issues and the issues that maybe this committee needs to grapple with? Okay, thanks, Judith. Yeah, you can talk here.
Yeah.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning to the honourable members of Parliament. Thank you for this opportunity for us to come and address you today about South Africa's international obligations in terms of both the Convention Against Torture and also the OPCAT. I am aware that you have before you already a briefing note from Ms. Carol Johnson, so I'm aware that you've got some information. I'm also aware that the CSPRI has handed out a small little booklet called Preventing and Combating Torture in South Africa. I would recommend very strongly for all members of Parliament, when you do have time, to acquaint yourself with the content of this book. As today I'm going to just do a very short presentation, and it's literally just going to give you a taste of what the CAT and the UPCAT is all about. I hope it will not be too torturous and that I'll be able to at least whet your appetite a bit to go off and have a little bit, look in more detail with some of the other documents that we have given you and also to find out more about this important area. Just very quickly then, what I'll run through is I've also put in a bundle of handouts, just a one-pager on either side. This is just a very quick reference for members of Parliament in terms of the major treaty bodies of where we are, reports which are due and reports which are outstanding. So that really is just a very quick reference guide for everyone. So I'm just going to run through very quickly, tell you a little bit about CAT and UPCAT, and then jump back again to CAT and just to say where we are, what happened when South Africa appeared before the Committee of the UN. Also just touch on very briefly the UPR, the Universal Periodic Review, which we've mentioned a couple of times today. And then just to brief the Committee as well on some of the activities that as a Commission we've been involved in. And then just to highlight three areas where we think as a commission, this committee could potentially support us in the work of taking these issues forward. So the Convention Against Torture, and I think as South Africans, we often feel very uncomfortable about speaking about torture. But I think we need to remember as well that a lot of the impetus for why the Convention on Torture was eventually finalized, the drafting process, was due to the death of Steve Biko. So this convention is firmly grounded in the history of South Africa, and I think we should be mindful of that because it does place certain obligations on us to uphold what is contained in that convention and to ensure that we are a model state when it comes to dealing with issues of torture. So the convention was finally adopted in 1984. It's the Convention Against Torture, and perhaps just to stress, it's not just torture, it's also cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment or punishment. And in terms of the Convention Against Torture, we then, at the UN in Geneva, have the Committee Against Torture, to whom we as a country must report in terms of how we are complying with our international obligations. I've also just put up in the slide and pointed out to you just the definition of torture, just to highlight it, it involves an act which includes severe pain and suffering. It must be intentionally inflicted, and it must be at the instigation or the consent or acquiescence of a public official or other person acting in an official capacity. And I pointed out there that currently, and I'm going to come back to this a number of times, South Africa does not have a specific crime of torture. So in instance, where an incident of torture has occurred, we have to rely on some of our common law crimes, such as assault, murder, etc. And we don't have a specific crime on our statute books in order for the state to demonstrate the the crime which has been committed, when it is in fact an act of torture and not a common law crime. To run through it quickly then, in terms of the UPCAT is an optional protocol to the Convention Against Torture, and what it does is it establishes a preventative mechanism to ensure that torture does not take place. So rather waiting for incident of torture to occur and then to address the incident, what the UPCAT does is it aims to prevent all types of torture from taking place. And essentially what the UPCAT is goes about requesting states to establish what we call an NPM, which is a national preventative mechanism. And all a national preventative mechanism is a regular system of visits to all places where persons are deprived of their liberty. And perhaps just to point out what these places are, of course the first places that come to mind are your prisons, but it also includes your police cells. And we know that from time to time there are reports of various forms of abuse and potentially torture that do occur in our police cells. It goes broader than that. It also includes your mental institutions where people have been deprived of their liberty, drug rehab centers, the Lindela Repatriation Center. I think an interesting one would be the hospitals where people with multiple drug-resistant forms of TB that could potentially fall under UPCAT. And what I will also come to later on is also the safety sites which have been established as a result of the xenophobic violence. That could be a debatable issue as to whether people there have been deprived of their liberty and whether they would fall in terms of UPCAT. Very new areas of law which give rise to very interesting questions when it comes from a legal point of view. So just in terms of a visiting mechanisms that are established in terms of the UPCAT, I think the most important thing to know is it provides for two types of visiting mechanisms. The one is the international visiting mechanism, which is conducted by the SPT, which is the Subcommittee on the Prevention of Torture, which is the international body. But now clearly they can't go to every place where persons are deprived of their liberty on a daily basis. So something is needed at a domestic level, and that would be your NPM, your National Preventative Mechanism, which is your system of regular visits. And clearly in terms of the UPCAT then, it's expected that state parties will cooperate with both the SPT and the NPM. I'll just put this slide up there to recap, because I know certainly when this is new, it gets very confusing. We're going CAT, UPCAT, NPM, SPT. Just so that you can get it clear in your mind, CAT is the Committee on Torture, UPCAT is the Subcommittee on Torture, and it's under UPCAT that you have your National Preventative Mechanism. I think I have gone through what some of the powers are, but for purposes of time, I'll perhaps just go quickly. But certainly the powers of a National Preventative Mechanism would be to go on a regular basis, to go and inspect places of detention, to make recommendations to government. It's to prevent incidences of torture. So it's not to necessarily investigate instances of torture after the fact, but it's to look at conditions at places of torture, to make recommendations in order that torture does not take place, and also to assist with proposals and observations and to be involved in legislative processes. In order for the UPCAT to be effective, clearly the mechanism which is set up, the NPM which is set up, it needs to guarantee that you can have access to all the places of detention, that you've got access to the persons there, that you've got access to the relevant information, that you also have access with the subcommittee. So why should South Africa ratify UPCAT? I think it is important for us to ratify UPCAT. It would demonstrate an important step in South Africa's commitment to the eradication of torture. And perhaps what we should mention here is that certainly as the Commission, with our engagements at an international level, at the UN in Geneva, with the subcommittee on the prevention of torture, but also at a regional level where we've got the Robben Island guidelines, which is the regional mechanism to prevent torture. There is great expectations that South Africa is going to lead the way for the region. And there's a lot of hope and anticipation at this international level being placed on South Africa, that at the regional level we can demonstrate that we can set up a national preventative mechanism, that it is doable on the southern African part of the African continent. It will also assist and also help strengthen some of the existing oversight mechanisms we've got, such as the judicial inspector and also the ICD, which looks into complaints against police. Just in terms of some of the practicalities, because often I think when government or parliamentarians, or in fact anyone, first years of an MPM, one can be quite overwhelmed and you think this is going to take enormous resources, it's not doable, but it really is doable. What a lot of countries who are in the process of establishing NPMs have done is they do not set up a separate mechanism. Rather, what they do is they work with existing structures and see how, in terms of existing structures, they can tweak, they can change things a bit. There's a large reliance on volunteers to, as part of a civic duty and volunteerism, to actually carry out the visits to the jails, to the police cells, and to do that though and send that information through to the NPM. What is important and what needs to be realized is that the NPM which is established must be functionally independent. It must consist of individuals with the necessary capabilities and expertise, that have access to the necessary resources, and also be in line with the Paris principles in terms of issues of independence. I think then where I'm just going to turn to, so that I don't take up too much of your time, but the committee may be interested in your own time, just to go through what we've done, just summarize a few issues from the last time South Africa appeared before the UN Committee Against Torture, and in their concluding observations and recommendations, what some of their concerns were. I've mentioned some of them, but it's interesting now when we sit post the outbreak of xenophobic violence, that even the CAT Committee, as well as the third committee, as our deputy chair mentioned, raised specific issues around asylum seekers, refugees, conditions of detention in Mandela, and asking that we actually address these issues. And just to note that some of those issues, the committee, what they do is when they are particularly concerned about an issue, they will ask the country not to wait out the 3 or 4 year period until the next report is due, but they ask the country to report back within 1 year. And on some of these issues, the South African government should have reported back by the 6th of December 2007. This has not occurred to the best of our knowledge, and therefore this report is outstanding. And the issues they wanted addressed were related to the specific offence of torture, the allegations of ill treatment of documented and undocumented citizens, also issues around legal aid and access to justice of people. Also, the committee wanted numbers on the number of incidents of torture, and also they had particular concerns about violence against women and children. So that report is due. In terms of the universal periodic review process, then briefly, it's a new mechanism by the Human Rights Council. On the 11th of June, just 2 weeks ago, the Council adopted the report, and one of the recommendations that was made was that South Africa should ratify the UPCAT. Just very briefly then, the Commission has been involved in a number of activities around the CAT and the UPCAT. We've set up a Section 5 committee on torture. Some of the members of that committee are here with us today, such as Lucas Munting, who's one of the NGO members of that committee. and then also members Kudio Morris and also the judge from the JI. They also sit on that committee. And that committee has been in existence for a year now, and essentially what the committee has been doing is trying to explore some of the issues and try and work out where civil society and the commission, we can move with these issues. We've also raised a number of issues which we've been involved in, and I'll leave that for the committee to go through. Perhaps just very briefly to mention, with the outbreak of xenophobic violence down in the Western Cape, what we've done is we have set up a monitoring mechanism in the various refugee camps, and our international member of our Section 5 committee, when we met them in Geneva 10 days ago, was very excited because in their view, this monitoring mechanism we have set up is in very close compliance to an MPM. And this was without us realizing that this monitoring could possibly be that. And we have just also added to the bundle a few reports as to the kinds of monitoring we have been doing. And it is pleasing to see that after a second follow-up report, that there have been improvements in some of the conditions which we had pointed out to disaster management and to the Premier's office. So the main reason for being here today is just to point out where we think this committee, where we could have some discussion and maybe assistance from this committee as well, is one, the issue around the criminalization of torture in terms of where is that legislation. It would, in all probability, come to this committee, and therefore this is an issue for the committee to flag and to also assist the commission in ensuring that it comes here. Also, in terms of the follow-up report to the CAT committee, it is very important as well. Many of those issues are issues which this committee deals with. And then also just in terms of the UPCAT needing to be ratified, the Section 5 committee feels strongly that, yes, one can write to the government, to the executive, but there's a strong feeling there's a need for us to identify champions, champions within civil society, within parliament, within the executive, within government, who are willing really to work and to take on this issue of the UPCAT in order to ensure that it is ratified, that we do set up a national preventative mechanism, and that we do prevent incidences of torture occurring in South Africa.
That's our presentation, I think. Yeah, thank you.
Okay, to get Johnson now.
Yes, Chair, I think can we move on to questions? While we have the Department of Justice here, just to ask them whether, from the side of the committee, if there is a bill that criminalizes torture, we definitely haven't seen it. So maybe just to hear from the Department of Justice where they are with that process, at what stage, and which stakeholders have been consulted at this stage, if any. And then secondly, if the Department could also maybe just respond on the issue, the South African response that was due at the end of last year, where that response is. And then it's also sort of fairly public knowledge that we did respond, South Africa did respond and say that there were no political hurdles in the way of the ratification of OPCAT. So then the question that begs to be answered is why haven't we ratified it? So we just hear from the department.
Before the department respond, I would like to welcome the two magistrates who have just joined us. Magistrate Schumann, can you wave your hand? As well as Magistrate Hussein, all the way from EE, Port Elizabeth. You are welcome. Thank you. Can I just clear up? You spoke about the inspector at the back there. Is he going to make any presentation?
I think if the committee were to be so kind, I'm sure they may have something specific which they think is very important, which maybe I missed out on. Maybe Mr. Minton as well, if he wants to add anything.
Let us hear from the inspector. Is there anything you want to add? And then they ask Ms. Minton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for the opportunity to be here.
with Judge Van Sail, who is recently new in the organization. He's just taken over a month and a bit ago. So, but just in terms of the OPCAT and our participation in the Section 5 committee, what has become evident to us is that our existing systems of oversight, especially as far as it concerns our prisons or our correctional centers, are well-developed and could, with very minor adjustments and through a system of cooperation, could be adjusted and so that we meet the requirements of the preventative or the national preventative mechanism as explained in the OPCAT. So we don't foresee any major problems in terms of the oversight needed on all our correctional facilities, and that is significant in the fact that about 80% of all the prisons detained, all the people detained in our country in any case, are detained in correctional centers. So the vast majority of people would in any case be accommodated in terms of the existing oversight mechanisms. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for this opportunity. Ms. Curran's presentation was very complete, so I have little to add, but just one or two comments. I think from civil society's side, the most important thing for us to happen is that there must be continuous dialogue between civil society, government, and the national human rights institutions around OPCAT and the Convention Against Torture. I think it's counterproductive if we meet each other every 4 years in Geneva when the reports are presented. So I think from the committee's side, it will be very helpful if that process can be encouraged and facilitated. I just want to make one comment about the obligation to criminalize torture as is required by Article 4 of the Convention. I think we should regard this as an opportunity to look at legislation that will not only achieve that in its narrow sense, but also deal with the broader issues of compliance with the Convention Against Torture and OPCAT. And there are a range of issues that emerge. To name one is the manufacture and trade of equipment used in torture, but it's also the broader obligations under the Convention. I think in terms of the reporting, again, civil society has a role to contribute to country reporting, the initial reports as well as the periodic reports, and the Committee Against Torture in fact encourages governments to consult with civil society. So I think from our side we are very eager to cooperate with government on this, although one would always maintain one's independence. Chairperson, I will stop there. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Then the response from the... Okay.
Chair, can I just raise one area which is an area of concern for me? I happened to be in Geneva when this issue was raised about the process to criminalize torture. And the response from the government was as follows. The South African Constitution outlaws torture even during a state of emergency. Currently, the government is finalizing the Torture Criminalization Bill, which was at the stage of being responded to by civil society, and it would criminalize torture in accordance. Now, that can't be correct because we haven't seen the bill. So I think the point about just cooperating and sharing information is absolutely vital, because if we're going to do this, then Chapter 9 bodies and civil society should see the draft bill. And if that's what government is communicating in international fora, which is not the reality, it has all kinds of implications for, I thought I'd just raise that, Chair.
There's several responses. The first one is, and please don't take this as a slight to the committee or the members here, is that my colleague from the international relations was meant to be here, and we were meant to have a meeting this morning to just clear up some of the issues, and I don't want to speak out of turn because the line function really sits with the international relations. With respect to the
ratification. There are processes underway. Again, it hasn't been finalized, and I don't want to speak out of turn about that internal process at this stage. Similarly with the responses, and perhaps what if we may be just given an indulgence, because this committee actually has taken a lot of my time. In fact, I was considering lodging a complaint to the Human Rights Commission, because it's the second time before this committee in the last 2 weeks that I've had my family arrangements being discussed. Firstly, that my partner was discussing having two or three other wives, and then today I learned in through the committee that he might be considering farming soon. So I might lodge a complaint to the Human Rights Commission.
I would urge that complaint be submitted directly to me, Chair.
Just without saying that one is shirking the responsibility, and it shouldn't be that way, could we get a few days to just respond so that I have also the formal responses of the department, because we were unable, because John seems to still be unavailable, and he was on a flight, which we knew, so we could give you the responses in writing. I do know that there is internally a process also on the criminalization, and that is not purely set within our line function as the Department of Justice, because there have been internal processes. But again, my point is, because that's also partly with safety and security, I don't want to give responses that may I'm not 100%, and we haven't discussed, I'm 100% accurate about.
I just want to make a short comment, Ms. Clotten. You said that they were looking to South Africa as having answers. I think that's the impression one gets when you do some research. For example, when xenophobia broke out, I went to the library because my community radio station said to me, I must prepare something and come and explain to the listeners what is xenophobia. And then I found a document produced by the South African Human Rights Commission. I think it was a research done somewhere in 2001, I can't remember. Human Rights Commission, the commissioner for, yes, there was also another third party, I can't remember who was.
The National Consortium for Refugee Affairs, the NCRA.
Yes.
Three-party initiative, the Rollback Xenophobia Campaign.
Correct, yeah, that one, exactly. It's so beautiful, explaining difference between refugee, immigrants, illegal immigrants and the like, you see. And then, but also saying what should be done, for example, in educating people that foreign listeners should be treated with humanity. They are entitled to certain rights, education, and the like, you see. And then thereafter, I picked up on the xenophobia in Durban in the rest. But what is strange is that these things were not implemented. The community or the public was not educated. You see. What is taking place now, there's a lot of education on TV, on radio, on newspapers. I think if this was done some years back, this should have been prevented. Mm-hmm. And then, Comrade Philip, it's not an attack on you. But there is, I'm just explaining to you, because these are things which we hear when we move around, concerning the comments about the Human Rights Commission, specifically the Akil. It is said that Inkatha used it during the problem of changing the name. They were openly saying, if they change the name in Lazi and the like, people will be killed, but you didn't come and speak and reprimand them about that. And then they also said, as a Human Rights Commission, Jesus, Zuma's rights were sort of violated. It even took the public protector, Mushwana, to say his rights had been violated. But the Human Rights Commission was silent about it. And what is your comment, really?
Thanks, Chair.
Okay.
Chair, I think following the development of the rollback xenophobia strategy, we did in fact undertake various campaigns, and some of them were fascinating. There was a radio program, a radio campaign, and a photographic campaign, which said basically we got people from the refugee community, we got a journalist from the SABC to train them to do interviews. Each was then given a tape recorder, and they went out and did interviews in their communities. It was an interview done by a refugee within the community, and those were one-minute clips that played actually on SABC radio stations across the country. We did work, for example, on a photographic where we got disposable cameras, and we had a photographer to come and show people how to use it, refugees. They went and took photos, and those photos were taken by themselves about their communities. We did training with the Media Institute, the Institute for the Advancement of Journalism. So there were things done, but I think maybe not enough and not on a sustainable basis, because that was a tripartite protest that came to an end. But the Deputy Chair will speak more to that. Chair, with regard to the kind of double standard accusation against the Commission, I'm not aware of the threat to kill by Inkatha, and maybe we missed it, but I'm not certainly aware that it was articulated by leaders. If it was, it may have been articulated by masses in the streets, which doesn't make it any more acceptable. But I'm certainly not aware that people in leadership, and here in these two instances, we're dealing with people in leadership, people of influence. But we will certainly look at the Inkatha issue. And with regard to the rights of Mr. Zuma, I've been approached by the media with regard to that issue as well. And my response has been that Mr. Zuma's matters are, the public protector has made a report, but Mr. Zuma's matters are currently before courts of law. Mr. Zuma, to my knowledge, is adequately and ably represented in those matters. And the matters of a fair trial, etc., will be ventilated before the court. To my knowledge, none of the people with regard to raising issues on behalf of Mr. Zuma has approached us to say, please investigate this issue. And I'm not saying we should wait for a letter either, but in my view, those matters are being dealt with by the courts and will be ventilated as it is currently being dealt with in the Peter Maritzburg Court as well. So clearly the Commission doesn't get involved in matters that are currently before courts in any event. And I think it distracts from the key issue that we were trying to deal with as well. Thank you, Chair.
So if I may add to that, I certainly also didn't hear anything about killing during the issues around the name changes. But of course, you know, if it comes to attention, we can deal with that. Our concern over the weekend when we saw the march was whether is it appropriate for people to carry sticks when the Constitution actually provides for a peaceful and an armed assembly. And then I was actually speaking to my staff members to consider an intervention. Then we had two problems. One was that the petition was received by government officials with people carrying those sticks. And then we also had an interview in the morning by the national organizer of the IFP, who was saying that the police were very happy with a peaceful march, and the disruption was actually caused by a road police officer, and the commissioner is investigating that. Now, then I was saying to my colleagues that we need to look into this issue as to whether does the law allow people to carry sticks, Zulus to carry sticks when they're marching, because we could not understand why then permission was given for the march and why the march was actually not stopped. So it's an issue which, you know, we're still toying about, but it was kind of, it was very confusing for us because we saw the march on TV and nobody really raised up until now the issue of the sticks, and we're just wondering. And also when the coordinator was asked that, you know, people were carrying weapons, he said he never saw any weapons at all, and if people have any reports of that, they can bring them to the ICC's attention. So I think that issue which still needs to be addressed, especially as far as the issues of cultural weapons are concerned, that maybe a Zulu man carrying a stick is part of him being Zulu and therefore not a violation of the Constitution. And it's something which, you know, we'll be looking into. But certainly, we don't take double standards, definitely. And then on the issue of the Mr. Jacobs, just to add, in terms of our complaints handling procedures, we don't really deal with matters before another constitutional body, unless the complaint about that particular constitutional body. So
So Mr. Zuma has always been, being handled by constitutional bodies, whether it's the police or public protector or the courts or whatever. And really for us then, you know, we did not really see the need of intervening when those people are actually dealing with those matters. It's not really about the double standards at all.
Let me just add a few words to the chair's comment to your question around advocate work on xenophobia.
Yes,
I think, let me just say that it's major. Now, human rights work is very long term. Advocacy around human rights is not something that you're going to see the results of in 1 year, as we have come to learn. I mean, well, 8 years since we started our campaigns around xenophobia, beginning with the initiative around the Robert Xenophobia campaign that the chair has alluded to. And flowing from there, we devised a program, training programs for frontline officials such as your police, your immigration officials. And this has been going on. Unfortunately, they haven't been sustained, as Chair was saying. But we still have a researcher who goes around the country doing that same training of officials of government departments. But of course, one person alone from the South African Human Rights Commission will not be enough to deal with the many, many issues of xenophobia on the ground that we are grappling with now, where communities are saying, look, we hear what you're saying, we hear they've got rights, but we also need to have jobs. They're taking our jobs away from us. They're bringing crime to our communities. They are taking our houses away from us. And so I think we also have to deal with the fact that, you know, xenophobia is an international phenomenon, especially where economies are unable to deal with the day-to-day issues of access to services. I mean, we saw a flare-up of xenophobic violence in France, for example, not too long ago, and it's a hot political issue. So I don't think we should look at what is happening here as something that is unique to South Africa. Of course, having said that, we cannot stop in our initiatives, and I think we have to redouble our efforts and partner with like-minded organizations to step up our campaign. Certainly, we have lobbied at the level of local government, for example, the city of Johannesburg, through a whole lot of this advocacy work and lobbying work, have now set up what they refer to as a migrant desk. Initially, that migrant desk is to actually educate and share information with service providers around, you know, the fact that everybody in South Africa has to have access to medical care, especially emergency health care, and educational matters, issues of social assistance. So at the level of local government, it's how the process is starting. And I just read a document from them in the wake of this xenophobic text. But they are now going to increase that migrant desk to a full-fledged unit of the Department of Social Welfare in the city of Joburg. And I'm sure this example will spread to other cities, because indeed the xenophobic attacks take place in mainly major cities, Joburg, Cape Town, Port Elizabeth, Durban, and so on. But I think we also need to engage more at community level, because we've been pitching our interventions mainly at government departments. And again, through the fact that we are really keen on the ground as well, we haven't had as much of a, you know, we haven't made inroads at community level, and I think that's where problems really are at this point in time. So, Chair, without much, without taking too much time, I would think that program is still hot on our front burners, and we'll do the best that we can to ensure that communities are aware that the rights that we have as enshrined in the institution are not just solely for artists and doctors. And if I were to a third time, I would have also gone into, you know, that whole dynamic around South Africans really not wanting to understand this. Not that they don't know, but they just do not want to deal with the fact that other people who are in this country also have. And I think it's says, very briefly, an effect of the racist past that we come from, where there was this system of hierarchy, of privilege, and now that we claim or we think that we have attained the status of being equal citizens in this country, we have to invent others that we have to also find, you know, lower than us or even not part of us or excluded from us. But those are matters to be taken elsewhere outside.
Yeah, just two short questions. Before you respond, maybe you can also answer them. There are talks that it would appear that what we are faced with is not xenophobia. Even people were at this stage hesitant to call it xenophobia, because they say out of 62 people, 21 are South African. And I want to hear your comment, whether are you convinced it's xenophobia or it's just a pure criminal element and the like. And then also to say, the DPD is speaking about the racial past we come from. For example, a person who comes from Lesotho in South Africa is not regarded as a foreigner, as well as continent. People go in and out in continent, they don't regard those people as foreigners. It's only Mozambique and Zimbabwe. There is hostility against those people. But you will recall that during the apartheid government, it was also targeting those people not to come into South Africa. You can take it further to say a white person can come from England today and open a shop. Nobody will say this is a foreigner or buy a fan and the like. At no stage they will regard that person as a foreigner. So it would appear that our attitude is skewed, influenced by the past, by the racial past we are coming from. It's my observation.
Thanks, Chair. I think the Deputy Chair has begun to allude to that already in the answer, but I do think that it would be problematic simply to ascribe violence to criminality. While I do think that criminals may well have exploited or taken advantage of the situation that was developing, I think it has correctly been pointed out that the contributing factors, and we still wait to see the report from the Government Interministerial Committee, would allude to a number of factors. And I think some of them would include, for example, xenophobic tendencies. But one hopes that report is nuanced enough to outline, in a sense, how some communities have across unnatural borders seen themselves as part of the same community, and where the issue of difference and the other is not an issue. Whereas in other contexts, that difference is reinforced and highlighted to the extent that it should not be. I live in a community, for example, that has many non-nationals, but because they share a common religion with people in the community, there seems to be no problem. So what does that mean? Are they acceptable because there's another basis on which you can associate with them? So, Chair, yes, I think we must examine it, not in a simplistic way, but in understanding both the history and also the current social and economic context. The current social and economic context that ordinary South Africans, rightly or wrongly, say, well, people who come here from across our borders do well. And understandably so. Someone from Zimbabwe doesn't come here to be unemployed. You might as well be unemployed in Zimbabwe or in Mozambique. So it'd be interesting to look at unemployment figures, for example, amongst non-nationals, whether they are illegal or not. And I would imagine the answer to that would be that they probably enjoy higher rates of employment than South Africans, because they don't have access to grants, etc. And therefore, in a community, would invariably do better in a short space of time than local people. And what is the impact of that in terms of difference? But lastly, Chair, I think apart from xenophobic violence, in the last few months we've also seen racist violence if you look at Kirk and the Free State University. We've seen homophobic violence if you look at the murder of the Banyana soccer player. We've seen violence on the basis of gender if you look at what happened at the North Spring taxi rank in Umlani. So it's necessary to look at what has happened now within the broader context of how difficult we have in dealing with the other, with that, or that which is different. And perhaps we should also not just focus unduly on the xenophobic, but look at it within the broader context of how we deal with difference. But I'm sure the Deputy Chair may want to say a word or two as well.
I think it's unfortunate that in South Africa the kind of xenophobia we see is a racialized one, as you rightly pointed out, Chair. It's not directed at people coming from other parts of the world, but only South Africans. I mean, like Africans from other parts of Africa. And I think there are all kinds of historical reasons for that. Secondly, the issue of access to economic opportunities and services will always be with us, because on the one hand, xenophobia is made up of these negative perceptions, but they are also, I mean, xenophobia is also about an interplay, a dynamic interplay between social, economic factors, and at this point in time, it's about high rates of unemployment, and therefore those frustrations, that anger that people have at not realizing that better quality of life that was promised 14 years ago at the dawn of our new South Africa has now come out in the form of this xenophobia that is directed at people who are seen to be taking these services away. And so it's a complex interplay. There isn't one factor that explains what is happening. It's like racism. But we have to go back to the history of the fact that South Africans also do not really know much about the rest of Africa. And years and years of apartheid indoctrination that said to us, look, those people beyond the Limpopo, interior, they come from the failed states, they are our South African blacks are better than them. It's all those kinds of perceptions that are working in the minds of people and end up giving people the impression that Africans from other parts of the continent are lesser human beings than us. Thank you.
Okay.
Very
brief, Mama Chang.
I've been raising my hand a long time ago, so I'm not going to break. I must take my time.
Yes,
I think on a lighter note, I would like to know from the Commission if there is a cat and object committee in Zimbabwe, because we designated there. And secondly, you know, the problem here is that there are so many instruments that have been put in place, especially for violation of human rights. But then the problem is that they are not publicized. The people out there do not know about what they are talking to. For instance, yesterday, we're discussing the debate on the parliamentary review process on the equality court. And we found that here in the whole republic, all high courts have got equality court and equality court. And that in the provinces, all the provinces have got equality court. But people don't know about that. Some officials, SAPS chief headmen, they don't know about equality court. The instruments that will be used by the people when they for these cases that we are speaking about. And I'm happy that the department is here. I see David Kotana is here. Something has to be done in order to promote all the instruments, the government instruments that are there to assist the people. It's a big concern. This is my concern. Thank you.
Thank you, Mama Shower.
Very briefly, Chair, on a lighter note, I think there is an OPCAT committee in Zimbabwe, but I think they're all in detention because of this. But no, there isn't one now. I think the point about making people aware of this court is vital. Recently, we had the lower court management committee, that is, four chief magistrates, come to visit us to talk about various issues. But one is hoping that perhaps in the meeting with the minister on the 3rd of July, when we talk about advocacy, we can also put on the agenda public awareness around equality courts, because people are being discriminated against. The court is in the same town, but people don't know there's a court that exists. So I think we take the point.
Yeah, on the second issue, it definitely is a responsibility of government in terms of international treaties to publicize those treaties, including translating those conventions into local languages. That has not happened. And maybe it will be an interesting thing to actually ask out from the relevant department as to how much of this budget is actually allocated to really raising awareness on this. The other option, of course, it could give us more money on this matter, the system as well. On the latter note.
Some few announcements. I omitted to say why the two magistrates are here. Maybe some of you will be wondering why are they not in the court sending criminals to jail. Mr. Skumar and Mr. Hossein from PE are in charge of the, from, or PE and Bloemfontein. Mr. Skumar from Bloemfontein and Mr. Hossein from PE. They are in charge of the one-stop justice center. So we are busy with the child justice bill. We went out and visited them, their centers, to see whether the state has capacity to can implement this bill we are about to pass. So they are here today because we have ongoing discussions with them, etc. More specifically, the debate. Yeah, today is the debate of the child justice bill. And then anyone in this house who wants to attend the debate, there are gallery tickets available. We can make them available to you. And then we must apologize. We prepared the descent large down there, but unfortunately there is youth parliament today. Every year at this time, the youth of this country converge here in parliament and debate their issues and the like. So unfortunately today we can't use the hall down there. We have seen a lunch in this room. We apologize for that. You are invited to the lunch. And then lastly, I must apologize. I may not stay long. This should not be recorded.
We'd just like to thank the committee as well for the time we've had with you. I think it was a useful engagement. I'm not sure from the chairperson's remarks whether we're going to come back before this committee with our annual report, because he indicated you're going to sit for 6 days this year and probably not before the elections next year. If we come back before the same committee, we'd certainly be very happy to do so. But if we don't, we'd just like to take this opportunity of thanking this committee for the engagement we've had over the years. So it's really been very good for us as well. Some things have happened, others maybe not. Some things have been slow, some things could have been, but I think that's the nature of the beast, and we certainly took our duties in terms of accountability seriously, and we'd like to thank you and all the members of your committee as well. Thank you.
I must also thank you for the report and all the contributions we received today. They were quite informative. As a result, we had very few questions to ask. Okay, thank you very much.
Mr. Kifaya, are you part of the youth parliament?
Thank you.
Thank you.